Steve, thanks so much. Hi, everybody. It's me, Bill Left. Now, usually, Wendy is here, and she's not today. She wasn't yesterday, and she won't be on Monday. Spoiler alert. She'll be back on Tuesday. Sitting in for Wendy today for the first show, the first part of the show, is you, Dave Ennett. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Bill.
This is going to be fun.
It will be fun.
I've been
fun.
Looking forward to this for a week.
Me too.
This
thanks
is be
for
great.
Having me.
In the second half, more fun, Jim Toronto. Elton Jim Toronto will be sitting exactly where you are, Dave. You can stay if you want to.
Well, if he's going to sit here, I better move.
It'd be uncomfortable
yes.
for both of you to sit mm-hmm. in the same chair. I get that. Earlier, not just the sporting world, but the entire world got some very, very sad news, and that is the man that has been called Mr. Hockey for decades and decades, Gordie Howe, has died at the age of 88, I believe, right?
88 years old.
So I was thinking initially, and I'm sure the same thought came to you, that within a span of just over a week, a little over a week, we lost the greatest boxer of all time, Muhammad Ali, and now arguably one of the greatest, if not the greatest, hockey player of all time.
Well, guys certainly would be on the Mount Rushmore of the NHL.
He would be.
And a man who played, it's unbelievable when you look at what he did. He played 26 seasons mm-hmm. in the National Hockey League, plus a few more in the WHA, mm-hmm. the World Hockey Association, which sprung up to rival the NHL. Later, and that's where he played with his sons for the first time, with the Houston Aeros. But he broke into the league, the NHL, with the Red Wings in 1946. Now, think about it. We're just coming out of World War II.
Right.
Right? And he played till 1980.
Yeah. Yeah. At the age of 51, was he when
51,
he retired?
He was 51. 50 or 51. And then he came back and played one shift in a minor league game for the International Hockey League Detroit Vipers when he was 69 years old.
Wow.
And he's the only man to play professional hockey in six decades.
Wow. Similar to what Minnie Minoso did with the
yep.
White Sox.
Yep.
They brought him back a time or two after he had retired just to say that Minnie played a game in another decade. And I know they wanted to do it again. Boy, what would it have been, the 90s or the zeros, the thousands? I think in the thousands, they entertained the idea for a little bit.
They talked about it.
Yeah, and then decided against it.
The difference, as great a player as Minnie Minoso was and a Hall of Fame caliber player, you're talking with Gordie Howe, a man who is second all-time in goals.
Yeah.
He's a six-time scoring champ,
yeah.
six-time MVP, a perennial all-star.
Yeah.
And granted, he played in the original six era,
right?
Which
does that help him or hurt him?
Well, I mean, I guess the travel was different.
Sure,
than
it was.
It
yeah.
is for today's players.
Yeah,
but they didn't go as far as today's players do.
Right.
But I think it was different. Remember, he played without a helmet.
I know. It's still jarring when you see either footage or pictures of those players. And they're totally uncovered, and you think to yourself, how did guys not get killed on a weekly basis?
Oh, I know. I mean, you think about it today, and it's unthinkable
right.
that a guy would be on the ice without a helmet. And, I mean, as recently as the 80s, there were players without helmets and
yeah.
visors, and now, obviously, it's the law. Some guys were grandfathered
in. I was just going to say, players had the option once helmets became a necessity. If you had been in the league and played without a helmet, they said, we leave that up to you.
Remember right. Al Secord?
Yeah.
Didn't
yeah,
play
yeah, yeah.
Doug Wilson
yep.
with the Hawks. They,
right.
They
opted out on the helmets.
I don't know why you wouldn't. I mean, I guess if you were used to it, that was what
right.
you grew up with.
Right.
But, I mean, I got to think that you took such punishment.
Oh, easily.
But Gordie Howe was still... up until the last few years,
yeah.
and he had undergone some health problems. He had a terrible stroke 2 years
yeah.
ago. But up until then, he had been pretty visible still
mm-hmm.
and pretty active. His wife died a number of years ago,
yeah.
and then he wasn't seen quite as much. But I think maybe 2-3 years ago, the Blackhawks were playing in Detroit on a Sunday afternoon. This couldn't have been more than 2 years. It was probably the year... just a few months before he had a stroke.
Yeah.
And the Blackhawks were playing a Sunday game, and Gordie Howe was there at Joe Louis Arena.
Yeah.
I remember them showing him on television. He might have been honored that day,
yeah.
too. So the guy did just some unbelievable things. And when you talk about the all-time greats in the game, he's one of them.
So the guys that would also be in that conversation are probably Wayne Gretzky,
mm-hmm.
probably Bobby Orr, I'm trying to think of who else would be.
Grant Mulvey.
Grant Mulvey certainly is going to be in that argument. What made him different or alike to those other amazing players? He didn't seem to me to be quite, to me anyway, quite as aggressive as some of the others, was he?
No.
He just seemed to lay back in the weeds and wait till he got the puck and then worked magic with it.
And then he did. Yeah, I think what you look at with him is his productivity over a long period of time.
801 goals.
Yeah, consistency.
Yeah.
Over 26 seasons.
Yeah.
I mean, he was always there. He was always among the leaders, and he was a winner.
Yeah.
I mean, they won four Stanley Cups in a short span of time in the 50s. Look, no less an authority than Scotty Bowman has said he is your number one all-time player.
How about that?
I kind of think he's seen a little hockey in his day, and I would tend to trust right. what he says.
Right, right. But isn't it crazy? Like I said, within a span of just over 7 days, you lose two key people in the landscape of sports. You lose Muhammad Ali,
sure.
and you lose Gordie Howe, and it's just both of those stories are so jarring. You know it's inevitable, but still when it happens, it's hard to take.
Yeah, it's different, obviously, because Ali was a man who had such an impact on society. I'm not saying Gordie Howe didn't in his own way, but he was a professional athlete and one of the greats in his sport.
Right.
It wasn't that he took a particular stand that made him well known. I think what really probably made him best known to a lot of people who are maybe casual fans was coming back and playing with his sons
yeah.
at the end of his career.
Right.
And for a number of years in the WHA.
Help me out with this, Dave, because I was jarring my head on the way in, trying to think of anyone else who's done that. And of course, Ken Griffey Sr. and Jr. playing together for the Mariners
right.
comes to mind. But can you think, is there anybody else that you can think of where it was a father and son playing the same sport, the same team at the same time?
Not the same time. I mean, those are the
those
examples.
Are about the two, right?
There may have been another one, but those are the ones. And I'm sure it's been tried or done as a publicity stunt
yeah,
by
maybe.
Some team, some place.
Yeah.
But this was a case, I don't think it was publicity. First of all, his kids could play,
mm-hmm.
and he wanted the opportunity to play with them. And who would possibly begrudge him that? And the fact that they were able to play together and win,
right.
I think, says a lot. And who wouldn't want that chance, right? I mean, if you were a professional athlete
sure.
and your son or daughter
yeah.
played, wouldn't you want the chance to 100%. Play alongside them?
Yeah. I always thought, because I remember hearing clips of those games when he played with, it was Mark and Marty, right, were his
Correct.
Sons, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I remember hearing clips, but I remember seeing games where Ken Griffey Sr. and Jr. were in the outfield together and just thinking, the odds of that are 1,000,000 to 1. Good for them, you know. And they were both. I mean, Ken Griffey Sr. at that point was in his waning years, and Ken Griffey Jr. was just an up and comer. But you think to yourself, boy, that what a feeling that must be.
I mean, you've had other families, the Boones,
oh yeah,
the Bells, Buddy Bell.
Yeah,
I think he might have been third generation.
He was
major leaguer.
He was. But, I remember from the back of the baseball card.
But he never played alongside his dad.
No. It's quite an accomplishment.
Because think about it. You have to have great longevity
right.
on the part of the father.
Yeah.
And the kid has to come up at a relatively early stage of his career to
right.
get to the major leagues.
Right.
So it isn't going to happen very often.
It can't.
No.
It really can't.
No.
But when it does, it's fun to watch. So certainly some very sad news for the hockey world, for the sports world, for all of us to see Gordie Howe, the man known as Mr. Hockey. That's something else I wanted to ask you. I'm trying to think in other sports. Mm-hmm. I guess the closest to there's Donnie Baseball, Don Mattingly. Was there a Mr. Baseball?
Yeah,
was
Bob Uecker.
Oh, Bob Uecker was Mr. Baseball. You're right. I forgot about that. I forgot. But is there Mr. Football? Is there Mr. Basketball? I know there's Mr. Coffee. It was Joe DiMaggio.
Correct. It's interesting because there are Mr. Football and Mr. Basketball awards
right.
in every state.
Right. Oh, there
the
is.
Top high school players.
Yeah.
Every year, there's a Mr. Basketball and a Ms. Basketball.
Yeah.
In the state of Illinois.
Right.
Right? Indiana does
yeah,
it.
Yeah, every state gets
most
around.
States do it. But professionally, I don't know.
It's
that
hard
you've
to pinpoint.
Ever...
There's Johnny Football, but that's not going
that
as well.
That has not
no.
gone well at all.
Yeah.
Johnny Manziel has not done well with that title.
And there is a Johnny Hockey also.
Who's Johnny
it's
Hockey?
Johnny Goudreau, but he's
oh.
a young player up
there. Oh, oh, oh.
But I've always maintained that they stole that from Taves.
I think they did.
Right?
That should be his title.
If anybody's going to be Absolutely. Johnny Hockey, it should be
It should
Taves.
Be Johnny Taves. All right, we need to take a quick break. Dave Ennett is sitting in for Wendy today. If you want to jump in at any point during the show, the easiest way to do it is 312-981-7200. That's our call line and our text line. A lot ahead. It's Bill and Dave on WGN. It's Bill left, and then Dave Ennett is sitting right over there filling in for Wendy, who is on vacation. We were just telling you some fun facts about Gordie Howe. Gordie Howe, known affectionately as Mr. Hockey for decades and decades and decades, sadly passed away earlier this morning at the age of 88. A couple of things, Dave, have come in over the text line. Number one is we've had a couple of people texting, mentioning here. I'll read one verbatim to you from 630. Gordie Howe played when there were only 120 NHL players. The talent level at the time was very high. Mm-hmm. Several stars on each team. Now there are close to 700 players in the NHL, and that's a huge difference. It is, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's a very fair statement. It's a different time. I mean, it's very hard to compare today to 1946. Mm-hmm. No question. You've got a different level of talent, but you also didn't have the European players,
right?
Right. I mean, right. You didn't have the Russian players. You didn't have the Swedes.
It was predominantly Canadian players.
You didn't have the great American players,
right?
You had pretty much all Canadian players.
We would steal Canada's best players, well, and we still do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Gordie Howe was from Saskatoon.
Yeah. Yeah. 847 says Gordie Howe was the first player to reach 100 points in a season. I believe that is correct. Mm-hmm. I'm almost positive that is correct.
And you remember Patrick Kane did it this year, and it was a major milestone.
First American to do it, right?
Right.
Now you and I were – oh, this one's funny. I don't want to leave this one out. I only know Gordie Howe because Bart Simpson used his picture whenever he would set up a fake blind date for Mrs. Krabappel. That's true on The Simpsons. Anytime he's trying to fix up his teacher, he uses a picture of Gordie Howe.
I don't remember that.
It's very funny. It's very funny. Now I asked you, who is the Mr. Fill-in-your-sport? As Gordie Howe was to hockey, who is to other sports? 773 says Mr. Ernie Banks is Mr. Baseball, right? He's Mr. Cub.
He is here. He's Mr. Cub.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's close.
I mean, I don't... It's tough because you can make a case for a number of Hall of Famers.
Mm-hmm.
If you were going to just dub somebody Mr. Baseball.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this was pretty much a nickname for Gordie Howe.
Right.
This isn't like somebody said, okay, who's Mr. Hockey? It's Gordie Howe.
Right.
But,
right.
I mean, how would you not say, would it be Henry Aaron? Would it be Babe Ruth? Would it be
That's tough.
Willie Mays? Would it be
any of those guys?
Mickey
would fit.
Mantle?
Right. Any of those guys.
Who would it be?
847 says, three generations of baseball players were all on the same team with the Ripkins, and that's true, not playing.
Yeah, right.
Cal Sr. was the manager, I believe, right, for a while right. his two sons,
Billy and Cal Jr.
Were playing for the Baltimore Orioles.
That's true.
Several people have mentioned that it's more common in auto racing for them to race at the same time. They list the Unser family.
Sure.
They list the Andretti family. Who was the other one? Was it were the Petty's father and son? I'm trying to remember.
The Unser. You mentioned the Unsers?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Michael and Mario Andretti.
Dale and Dale Jr.
The Earnhardts. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. All right. So for some reason, it does seem to play out a lot more in auto racing. But I guess just the confines of that sport would dictate that you could do it. You could start younger. You could end later. Right. The wear and tear on your body isn't what it is in more contact-filled sports.
A little bit. And there have been some golfers also who have, at least the careers have maybe overlapped
a little bit.
But again, it's not quite like being on the same team.
Right, right. 630 says, don't leave out the Mannings. True, but again, different eras, yeah, right?
Right, they didn't play together.
Right, they were all separate.
I mean, Peyton and Eli played at the same time,
right,
not for the same team, and Archie played way before them, obviously.
847 says, and I'm not positive this is true. I think you'll know this more than me. Bobby Hull and his son Brett played at the same time. Did they? I think
yeah,
there was...
they probably would have at the end, I think, but they were never Why? They were never on the same team.
I know for a fact they were never on the same team, but I'm almost positive because Bobby ended his career with a Canadian hockey team, right?
Right. Was he with? Right. He was with, yeah, out in Winnipeg.
With the
he came back and played 1 year, and I got to think of where he played. But yeah, they never played together.
I don't think simultaneously. I don't think. And then one more, another racing family, the Rahal family. That's Bobby Rahal, and his son's name escapes me. But they also raced at the same time. So it's a lot more prevalent in the world of racing than it is in other sports. All right, we'll take a break. Steve will give you the news, and then we have a lot coming up on the show, including the other side of cheating. We'll explain that in just a little bit. Stick around. It's Bill Leff and Dave Ennett sitting in for Wendy Snyder on WGN. We're caught in a trap. I can't walk out. It's Bill Leff and Dave Ennett sitting in for Wendy Snyder. Our guest right now is Dr. Paul DiPompo. Paul is a psychologist, an author, a speaker, a researcher. He's done several studies having to do with cheating, and he's co-authored a new book called The Other Woman's Affair. Paul, thanks for being here. How are you, sir?
Hey, I'm great. Hi, Bill. Hey, Dave.
Nice to talk to you. Here, this is a jarring statistic. I read this right off the top, and right off the bat, I'm scared. In the United States, up to 40% of married couples are having affairs. Please tell me that's inaccurate, please.
No, it's true. Up to 40%. You know, I was listening to your show yesterday, and there's a lot of Scott Steiners out there, you know, but they all don't have the same amount of luck as he has. And actually, it's actually very prevalent, especially in areas like the New East Side, Lincoln Park, Gold Coast. You know, the more affluent areas, it's even worse.
And why would that be?
I think that, you know, you could think of it from an evolutionary standpoint. I mean, a lot of times these people are very affluent. They've got a lot of control and power, and that's a very attractive quality, and people are drawn to that. And then people who are actually engaging in the affairs often have beliefs that they should be able to, you know, that they should have what they want. They deserve it. So it's a slippery slope.
Doctor, why are people, and I guess we're talking more about women, why are they willing to talk about this?
I know, it's interesting, because to us, when we were doing the study, we were nervous about this. This study took about 3 years in total. But when you think about it, if there's up to 40% of people who report having affairs, and, you know, only 10% of these actually work out, it leaves, in the country alone, it leaves about 15 million people that are just sort of left as the other. And there's so much shame involved with it. And you know how the media often portrays these people as, you know, harlots and, you know, like Glenn Close and Fatal Attraction and things like that, you know, but they even lie to their therapist. So even though it was very hard for them to talk about, once they saw that our research was real and that there was no judgment, and they really didn't care what we thought because we weren't their therapist, we weren't a friend or anyone like that, they were really anxious to talk about it. And the word spread, and we spoke to many, many people for many hours, and we followed them over the course of the relationship.
Paul, what in your findings have you found that people who do tend to engage in an affair are more likely to make this a multiple thing? Is it usually a one-time deal, and they go, okay, I strayed, and I know what it is now, and now I'm back to my wife or my husband, or has it become like a serial thing for them?
A lot of times, we mostly assessed the other, the man or the woman who was actually involved with this married person. But when we look at the married person, a lot of times it is not an isolated event for them. But for the other woman and the other man, it's often a single event for them. They're not seeking out a married man. More often than not, they're actually duped, thinking that the marriage was over, and they believe that, you know, that this is special enough. Once they actually learn the true status of the relationship, their heart's already in it, and they're in this crossroads, compromising their values, believing that it's true love. And so the anxiety really pops up for them then, because it's like they feel like this has to work out. I already compromised my values and my morals. So for the married partner, it could be quite of a serial thing, but the other isn't quite aware of that.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it? They get into this either not knowing that the other person is married, or believing that if they are married that the marriage is on the rocks and they're next in line, and it just doesn't end up working out for them.
Yeah, we call it like a Ponzi love because, you know, it's like a Bernie Madoff situation. They've given, and they're expecting that payoff. In the beginning, the payoff's great. The first 4 months are bliss. But then after that, and the reality sets in, they're just hanging in there anxiously, hoping that payoff will come, and only 10% of the time it does.
We're talking to Dr. Paul DePompo. His new book is The Other Woman's Affair. He's done extensive research on this. How much of this is just plain sex? I'm sure that plays a key role in any affair, but is there more to it than just that?
Well, you know, for the man, you know, there's let's just, even though this happens with men and women, if we're talking from the standpoint that the man is the married one, there's four main reasons. One, the man is high on narcissism. You know that the guy who's very attractive, chiseled, charming, and he believes he should have what he wants. There's another man who's more the lonely type. Maybe his wife's a little bit wearing the pants too much, invalidating him, and he feels like, you know, he feels very lonely. There's the sexually deprived man who the sex with the wife wasn't that good in the beginning of the relationship. He hoped it'd get better, and he just feels like he's completely missing out. And then the fourth type is really the Mr. Ready, someone who's really at peace that the relationship ran its course and is truly ready to move on. That's the rarest type, but the book helps you ferret out all those people. But for the woman, it's really the sex is not the most important part. She often feels like this man is going to, on some level, heal her situation, because a lot of times she grew up in a situation where she didn't have really good attachment to one of her parents, and she learned that the harder it is, you know, the more it'll be worth it, and she's really hoping for that emotional payoff in that true partner.
Paul, you can hang on for a little bit, right? You good with time? All right.
Oh, yeah.
Our guest is Dr. Paul DePompo. His book is The Other Woman's Affair. If you have any questions or comments, this would be the best time to call or text in, 312-981-7200. It's Bill Leff and Dave Ennett sitting in for Wendy Snyder on WGN. It's us. It's Bill Leff and Dave Ennett. Wendy Snyder's on vacation. We're talking to Dr. Paul DePompo. He has written a book called The Other Woman's Affair. Paul, years ago at a different radio station, we were doing a topic of infidelity, and we had several people, not just one, not just two, but several people call in and say basically the same thing, that they had an affair and it was the greatest thing for their marriage. How can that be?
Okay, so for the married couple, when an affair is discovered, it is an opportunity. I mean, one way to look at it is that the discovery of it is an actual gift, because sometimes, well, more often than not, when a relationship is running its course and it's starting to go down a path where you're living parallel lives, you need something big, right? You need something big then to shake it up and realize that there's something wrong. And hopefully in these situations, the person who had the affair is willing to do big things to make the changes. But then the other person, let's just say the man has to do big things, but the woman, she's going to have to do some things as well, because even though no one is but the man is responsible for his behavior, still both partners in the marriage do things that sort of set up a situation to grow apart. So it's an opportunity for change and real growth. We actually, at our practice, we do marital retreats, and we really help in a very short time these couples find out why this happened and how to rebuild effectively.
But you would never recommend this to a couple, would you?
To have an affair?
Yeah.
No, that would go horrible.
I would think so.
Yeah, that would go horrible, because a lot of times you end up one person ends up falling for the outside person, and then it's a train wreck. But it's sort of like don't let a catastrophe, you know, get worse. Take a catastrophe, turn it into something good.
But it brings up the question of trust going forward.
Mm-hmm.
And just as when the affair begins, and let's say a woman gets involved in an affair with a married man,
yes.
What's to say that even if he leaves his wife for her, mm-hmm. that he isn't going to leave her for somebody else down the road? And how can she ever trust him?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great question, because if this person is the kind that wants to avoid conflict, that's one of the biggest scary pieces of the equation, because if he's avoiding conflict with her and getting his needs met on the side, he's very likely to do that again. So the married partner has to have a timeline and actually follow through on what they say. We've got to see the steps. Behavior is way more important than what they say. So, and he's also got to be open and transparent, willing to have the difficult conversations. If you feel like this man is just telling you what you want to hear and reassuring you, but not having the difficult conversations about how he's ambivalent and confused and he's not being completely honest about it, that's a huge flag. And he has to engage in really big behaviors to show his commitment, like open up his phone. Don't be a secret to everyone. Let his best friend or someone during this process know who you are. If you're not seeing these signs, I would say you're very likely to get more of the same in your relationship with him.
It's funny you say that, and here's why, Paul. I always hear stories from people who say, my husband was cheating on me for 9 years. I had no idea. That's not possible, is it? If somebody that close to you, your husband or wife, is having an affair that's lasting years and years and years, there's no way you can't know it, is there?
Well, you're right. I mean, a lot of people get those feelings and then they tell themselves lies and things like that as a coping skill. And a lot of times that's what we saw these women were doing that were in these relationships. They would see all the signs that this person is not completely in it, but they would splice them off. And when you splice off reality, that's what makes you sick. It makes you start to feel anxious or depressed, because you have to work triple hard in order to splice things off. And that's what I see. And we see a lot of wives in this situation, too. They come in, they're depressed, they're anxious. They can't really put their finger on it. And then sometimes we suggest they trust but verify, trust their husband, but look a little bit more. And often, you know, they find things. So women and men, they should trust their instincts. And you could trust someone but still verify. That's not a bad thing.
Right. Here's a text from 630 area code. They want to know if there's any stats on how many women just flat out end the affair once they find out that the person they're with is married. Do you have stats like that?
We don't have stats like that, because the criteria for the study was that they were in the relationship when they knew it was an affair still, but pretty much every woman and man that we spoke to that was in the situation did break up with that man briefly and then felt such a hard attachment break that the man was able to kind of work their way back in. So initially they did break up, but through that grief, they told themselves things like, maybe this is special, maybe this is the one, maybe I could heal him from his wife's issues.
Yeah.
Doctor, if you had one piece of advice for either a woman or a man who finds he or him or herself in one of these relationships, what would it be?
The last thing we would want them to do is to wait or to put their life on hold, which so many do, and take two steps. One step, make sure you're moving on with your life so you feel like you're taking care of yourself regardless of what happens with this relationship. And two, make sure you have a timeline with this person that you're willing to follow through on. And if you can't follow through on that, then get help and be honest with your therapist.
Do you ever hear stories, Paul? I know this is extreme, but I'm sure you have at some point heard a story from a guy who'll go, hey, my wife told me to have an affair. She wants me to have an affair. It makes life easier for her if I'm having relations with some woman that's not her. Is that possible?
I've heard that many times in my practice, but it's often a test. So, you know, be careful for that test. And then if that's really true and that's not a test, you know, the man would need to question whether he wants to really be in a relationship with somebody that, is it really the intimacy and the partner, or is it the situation that she wants? Why does she want to maintain a relationship like that?
So by test, you mean essentially it's like, it's almost a trap. It's the wife saying, sure, go ahead, see what you got. And then if you find somebody, that's the problem.
Right. This is somebody often who doesn't want to really be in an intimate relationship anymore with her husband, but she doesn't want to take the responsibility for calling it quits and wants him to be the bad one.
We have a couple of texts that ask almost essentially the same thing. They're worded differently, but it's almost the same thing. Mm-hmm. So your thoughts on this. They both say words to the effect of, I could see having an affair after you've been married for 25, 30, 35 years, but what about young couples in their 20s who have just gotten married and are already having an affair? That's never going to work, is it? That's a recipe for disaster.
It is, and I think a lot of it, unfortunately, is coming up with the Y generation, they want to be free and they don't want a lot of rules or inhibitions, but at the same time, they want a close, committed relationship. So there's a whole conflict of interest there. And personality disorders, you know, like narcissism and things like that, they're actually on the rise. So if you've married someone and you're a young married person, and this person, your partner, meets the criteria of someone who is a little bit higher on the narcissism side and doesn't like to avoid, it doesn't like conflict, that is setting up a situation where you really have to be careful because you have a high chance of some infidelity happening.
Sure.
Not to digress, why is narcissism on the rise?
Narcissism on the rise because the way everyone's trying to figure that out, but what researchers are thinking most of all is that the Y generation was taught to be so entitled that they really are growing up believing that they should have what they want when they want it. And that's not a good mix for a long-standing relationship that's going to have its ups and downs.
Paul, as you say that, Dave and I are sitting on Michigan Avenue. I'm looking out the window watching several people taking selfies of themselves, and I'm shocked that narcissism is on the rise. I can't believe it. Shocking.
I agree.
The book is called The Other Woman's Affair. Paul DePompo is the co-author of that book, available wherever better books are sold. Paul, thank you very much for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. Thank you very much.
Have a great weekend. All right,
take
a quick break. Did I say books are sold? I think sold is probably the right.
But they're also sold.
Books are many times sold and then sold in that order. We'll take a quick break. Steve has the news and then more show coming your way next. It's Bill and Dave on WGN. Kurt Wagner is here, everybody. Kurt is the owner and proprietor, shopkeeper over at TVShowPatrol.com. One of the best websites having to do with all things television. How are you, Kurt? Nice to see you.
Hi.
This is Dave, by the way.
Hi,
Dave's
Dave.
In for Wendy.
Hi. Nice to meet you, Kurt.
Kurt, last night, I don't know if you got a chance to see this, Dave. I don't know if you got a chance to see this, but on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon, his guest, for most of the show, not the entire show, Madonna came on at the end, but the president, Barack Obama, was his guest, and he was, as you would imagine, very, very entertaining. Did you see him?
I did not.
He was really fun to watch. He's very, very comfortable. You know, comedy is not the easiest thing in the world. And usually if you're the president, it doesn't blend well.
Right.
I've seen other presidents not do quite as well in similar situations. But boy, was he funny last night on Jimmy Fallon.
Well, he's always killed at the
press corps dinners.
The press dinner thing,
yeah.
Too, right?
Yeah.
I understand.
So maybe that's his next career. When he's done with politics, maybe they'll give him a late-night show somewhere. That's possible. Speaking of late-night shows, I don't know if you know this story, but Stephen Colbert is in all kinds of trouble. They keep taking things away from his show and changing little bits and pieces of it. I know it's third in the ratings out of the three networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC, but what's gone wrong there? He was the golden boy for a little bit.
I guess it's not translating to the audience that is used to that time slot, I guess.
It's so weird. When he did the Colbert Report, he was doing essentially a character. He was doing kind of a blowhard political talk show, and I thought it was very funny. And now everybody said he'll do even better when he gets to play himself, and sadly the audience isn't picking up on it.
Well, I don't know that his audience necessarily moved over with him from Comedy Central. I mean, those are Comedy Central and late night NBC, is that?
CBS.
Or CBS?
Yeah.
Two different things.
Well, the other thing, did you see the Letterman interview with Tom Brokaw,
mm-hmm.
who's on the nightly news, and I guess they're running a longer chunk of it on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if he was necessarily out to undermine Stephen Colbert, but it seemed like it was hardly a real strong endorsement by Letterman. Because he said, didn't he say something like, they should have given the show to a woman?
Yeah.
Which, it's a great sentiment, but why would you say that?
It's very peculiar because the relationship between David Letterman and Stephen Colbert seemed to be pretty solid. Colbert had been a guest a few times, including at the end when they announced that he would be his replacement, and Dave seemed on board and happy with it. But and I have to say he makes a very valid point. The fact that one of those major shows, at least one, it should be more than one, isn't hosted by a woman is awful. There's no excuse for that.
Right, but it just seemed like it was a time where he could have said, well, I wish Colbert luck.
Right, and he didn't.
And he was asked, did they ask him about his successor? And he said, no, they just were glad I was leaving.
Well, here's what's strange, and I hope he was kidding about
that. Well, weren't
that.
They were always with Dave. They were in third, too, right? Not always, but for a large part of his run.
Mostly second. Jay Leno beat him incredibly often, and then when Kimmel was added to the mix, he and Dave kind of flip-flopped a little bit in the ratings. But if you'll remember, with the history of late night shows, part of the thing when Carson was stepping down is Johnny Carson was very, very upset that he wasn't a bigger voice in his replacement. And you would think that networks would look at that and go, yeah, it makes for a better blend if we bring in the guy that we've had for a long, long time. But CBS didn't really want to do that with David Letterman either. It's very strange.
Well, that would make sense, too, considering that a lot of times the network folks are maybe a little disconnected with what the audience might want, which you would think wouldn't be the case, but a lot of times it is.
Right. So I wonder what else will happen. Steve Cochran alluded to the fact that they're toying with the idea of switching the shows, that Stephen Colbert's show would go in an hour later and James Corden, who's on afterwards,
James Corden's
very funny.
Yeah, they just his little carpool karaoke thing. Branded that as a thing that now CBS owns and can other networks in other countries can pick it up and
syndicate it in other places
and make it with their own host.
Oh, that's interesting.
So they branded the concept.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Corden's show is more circus-like, like Jimmy Fallon's show, and everybody goes, that's the new model for what a 10:30 talk show would be, is not just a guy sitting down and talking to somebody who might be Secretary of State or running for office or an author, but playing games, playing $20,000 pyramid with them or making them do singing.
And it's a younger, I think he probably attracts a younger audience too.
Yeah.
Because who stays up that late?
Younger people, normally.
Yep.
And now even later with Bernie Sanders out of the race, all they can do is stay up and watch TV.
Imagine, though, if they do switch those two, how Colbert will feel about that.
It really would be a hard thing for him.
I'm
going to
finish my contract and then I'll be done.
Wouldn't that be something?
Yeah.
And they're paying him crazy amounts of money to do the show.
Right.
Really good money to lure him away from Comedy Central. They threw some big bait at him. So I think
the people used to tuning in at that hour probably, maybe they're not his audience.
Like, there used to be a loyalty, it seemed, when it was Leno and Letterman. You either went one way or the other, but I find myself on any given night, depending on who the guests are, I'll go either to one of the two Jimmys, to Fallon or Kimmel, or to Colbert. I don't seem to have the loyalty I had when Letterman was the host. Do you guys?
I don't, but I don't even watch them.
You don't
watch
them regularly?
I watch actually the clips a lot more on the next day.
The shows themselves.
Yeah. It's past my bedtime, Bill.
It's right. Yeah. That's not late.
Same here. But when I am up, I start with Fallon.
Do you?
I would probably be more like, a lot of times I'll go over and watch Johnny Carson on Antenna TV.
Do you? Yeah.
Because I still enjoy those.
They're the best.
They're great. And you see these shows from the 80s and from some of them going back to the 70s.
Yeah, they're fun to watch.
And it's nice. But I would probably go to Kimmel before I would go to Colbert.
Would you? Yeah, that's more.
It's a more interesting show.
All right, we'll take a quick break. Kurt Wagner will tell us about saved television shows. What are saved TV shows? You'll find out in just a little bit. It's Bill Leff and Dave Ennett sitting in for Wendy Snyder on WGN. Kurt Wagner's here. Kurt's got the website TVShowPatrol.com, which is right there on your internet. If you go to your internet and type in TVShowPatrol.com, you'll find Kurt's website.
It'll be me.
It's you. What exactly is a saved television show, Kurt?
Well, when shows are canceled, often the fan base will petition to try to get it saved, to try to get it moved to another network.
Mm-hmm.
And that just happened this week. Yesterday, as a matter of fact, a deal was struck between the makers of Nashville, which just was canceled on ABC after four seasons.
Right.
It is going to go to CMT, the Country Music Television Network.
That seems like a natural fit, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And then it's some deal with them and Hulu will air the episodes the day after, which they always do anyway. But I think they might be helping with the money situation, too. And it's some big deal. The Tennessean wrote the story. It involves the state of Tennessee, too.
Are they going to tax the people of Tennessee?
Well, it creates a lot of
tourism.
Of tourism and stuff in Tennessee.
Yeah.
And you know, the show has spawned albums and because all the actors sing their own music. And they've had country music guest stars on. So anyway, that'll start. I don't know when it'll start, but they're going to have a new season.
One of the things that I've heard about that show, and my wife is a huge fan. This is going to make her day to hear this news.
Mm-hmm.
And she was crushed when it was canceled. But the ratings have not been good. But it also spawned a national tour with the stars from the show. So there are other revenue streams for the show aside from the fact that, you know, maybe they're not getting the ratings that would sustain a network show in prime time, they're able to find some other ways to make it work, and I guess this is all part of it.
Well, as long as those fans have CMT, you know, those ratings that it had at ABC would be great for CMT. You know, it's a smaller cable network, you know. So,
right.
And it is a natural fit with the music and all that stuff.
Does this mean when a show goes from a network like ABC to a smaller cable outlet like CMT, does that mean less episodes per season?
It could be. It depends. There'll probably be less money in the mix.
Right.
So that would make more sense.
Do we know if most or if all the same stars are transferred? Nobody's saying yet.
They had a big cliffhanger to end the series to the end of the season, even though they knew the series was going to end because they were confident it would get picked up. So now I guess that will be found out.
Unless that
person decides not to come back.
Oh.
But I don't know any of those deals, deals have worked out.
I have some developing news.
What
on
is it,
that.
Dave?
The deal with CMT for Nashville is a full season, 22 episodes.
Oh, okay.
That's fantastic.
Wow.
Good. But it doesn't say if all the stars, because I know Hayden Panettiere is in it. Mm-hmm. And
Connie Britton,
who used to be on Friday Night Lights, is in it. Those are your two biggest stars, right? I'm trying to think.
Right.
Yeah.
Those are the biggest. And Connie Britton was on another show that was saved by a second network.
What was that?
Friday Night
Lights. It was Friday Night Lights. Yeah, the show I thought.
NBC and DirecTV made a deal when that happened to co-produce. And it lasted for two more seasons or three more seasons. Total of five. So
I remember years ago, Taxi started out on NBC. And then when NBC canceled it, I think it was ABC that picked it up for its last season. And it used to be in the old days where there were just three and then four networks. Those were your only options.
Right.
But now with Hulu and Netflix and stuff like that, it's limitless. Anyone could pick you up.
Yeah, exactly.
The Mindy Project is a great
example.
The
Mindy Project went to Hulu.
The Mindy Project is hysterically funny, and it ran its course on Fox, right. And it's just as funny, if not better, on Hulu.
Well, I did some research because I posted the story. I have 21 other shows that were saved by a network switch.
Give us some of them.
And Taxi, I don't remember seeing that. But
Taxi, just for a year, went over to ABC.
I'll have to check that out. Longmire, which we've talked about on the
right.
show before, was
right.
picked up on Netflix, and it'll have another season, fifth season. That they're filming now. Project Runway went from Bravo to Lifetime. Friday Night Lights, we mentioned.
Yeah.
Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt was actually canceled by NBC before it even aired.
Right.
I mean, they just decided they just didn't take it, so it moved to Netflix. Community was on NBC,
Yahoo
picked it up as a web series.
And Community's story was every year at the end of the season, they thought,
yes,
we're done. That never did well in the ratings.
No. But it was kind of a critical darling, and it had another rabid fan base.
Yeah.
Cougar Town was another show that went from ABC to TBS.
Yeah.
And lasted. Unforgettable went from CBS to USA.
I know this is trite to say, but I can't remember Unforgettable. What was Unforgettable? Was that the Western?
No, it was a crime drama. Where the woman had a memory, like she could remember everything exactly as it appeared. Southland was this great LAPD crime drama that was on NBC and never really picked up steam there.
And it got saved.
TNT and did really well on TNT.
Yeah, so there's
a ton of them.
It's not unprecedented.
Right.
No, both Leave It to Beaver and My Three Sons switched networks.
Is that true? I didn't know that.
Yes, so did Wonder Woman.
One went ABC to
which
CBS.
Yeah.
The other went CBS to ABC.
And those are classic television shows.
Right.
Those are classics. Well, I always wonder, because every year there's a show or two that I love, and I always think, well, this has been prematurely canceled. We've talked about the show The Family on ABC, where this kid comes back.
Right.
He was abducted as a small child, and he comes back. And I thought that show started good and was really building to something nice, and ABC canceled it after one season. So then I always think, but as a viewer, what can I possibly... I could send them a letter, but they'll throw that letter away, won't they?
Well, they do. You know, it depends. Online petitions sometimes help. There's been some cases. I don't think all of these 21... shows were really because of online petitions or at the time written petitions, but it could possibly help, sure.
Yeah.
It could help to convince maybe another network to pick them up.
Oh, maybe.
Not necessarily the network
original
that canceled it to bring it back. But here's one you'll love, Bill.
Hmm?
The Price is Right started on NBC
and
went to ABC.
To ABC, yeah.
And then it was resurrected after a couple years on CBS. So it's been on
all three major
networks.
How about that? There's a text for you, Kurt, from 773. They're anxious to find out about Code Black, remind me again what Code Black is.
It's a medical drama.
Okay.
On CBS. Know if that's I believe it did back? Get picked up for another season.
Yeah.
Last minute save, I think. And it'll remain on CBS, I think.
When is the next American Horror Story starting? That's from 773. That usually happens sometime in the fall, doesn't it?
Late winter fall? Or in January.
And then why did they cancel Heartbeat? What is Heartbeat?
Oh, that was an NBC medical drama.
Yeah. Why did that get canceled? Can I guess? Nobody knew what it was. Nobody knew it was on.
Is that ratings? Why? I've actually written some stuff about Heartbeat. I kind of liked it, but yeah. Didn't have very big ratings. They saved it. They pushed it sort of until mid-season of mid-season, like mid-spring of
this
year.
Once they start pushing it, that's a problem.
I don't think it just everybody is already watching stuff.
Tell us really quickly. We have less than a minute. Are there any shows premiering this week or anything special on TV that we really need to know about coming up?
The ABC/ESPN's doc on O.J. Simpson and that case and what led up to that
Saturday.
Case and everything starts Saturday on ABC and then it continues on ESPN after that. I think it's eight or nine parts. And I've seen the first episode and it's
great,
pretty tremendous.
It?
Yeah.
We had the guy on Edelman who wrote it, directed it and produced it. He was on with us on Wednesday. And it's one of those situations where you go, I kind of know the story. I know everything that happens. But no.
Yeah, there's a lot in there. And because of that, I think FX is running the whole season of American Crime Story.
Oh, they're rerunning it?
Yeah, they're rerunning it Saturday during the day.
Kurt, thank you so much. Yeah. Have a great weekend. That's Kurt Wagner again. His website, TVshowpatrol.com, easy to find and has great information about TV. Have a good weekend, Kurt. A quick break, then some news, and then more show. It's Bill and Dave in for Wendy on WGN. Tim, thank you very much. Hi, everybody. It's me, Bill Leff. Now, Wendy, who's normally here, is off today, and she'll be off Monday. But don't worry, she'll be back on Tuesday. She's just taking a vacation, that's all. Sitting in for her now is Dave Ennett. Sitting in for her later will be Jim Toronto. That happens when we return at 1 o'clock.
Takes two people
to replace Wendy.
For Wendy.
Yep. And even then, you say to yourself, is this enough coverage? I don't know if it is. Dave, I would think that one of the greatest honors anyone could ever have would be for a college or a university to call you up or send you a letter or an email saying, we want you to come to our college and give our commencement address. It would mean the world to us for you to speak your mind to the kids and set them on the path. Wouldn't that be a nice honor?
It would be a tremendous honor.
I don't anticipate anyone ever doing that to me. You've probably, has Northwestern or any other university ever said, Dave, we want you to come and address the kids?
No.
I'm shocked by that.
No.
You seem a natural for that.
No, it's okay.
Why wouldn't they ask you? My feelings are hurt for you right now. Why wouldn't Northwestern ask you?
Well, no. I mean, they've got many more distinguished people to ask.
I can't imagine it. A name doesn't come to my head. If I'm on the committee, you get the phone call from here on in.
Thank you. I'm busy anyway.
Well, right. That's better to have that in your head. Just even if they ask me, I'm going to turn them down. I'm going to say no. The reason I bring this up is Mike Rowe recently gave a commencement address. Now, you're familiar with Mike Rowe,
yes.
Correct?
He's the Dirty Jobs guy.
Yeah, he's the host of Dirty Jobs, and I guess he's been doing this sort of thing for quite a while. He's one of those guys that I marvel at who just has the innate ability to be able to fix things and make things work. I don't know how he does it. I don't have any of that in me, but Mike Rowe is very good at this. Well, he gave some advice to kids, and I have to be honest with you, I'm not positive that this is good advice. And I like Mike Rowe a lot. I've seen him on TV, on Dirty Jobs. I always like Mike.
But so was he in those commercials, car commercials?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, where people need something done and then Mike Rowe shows up and everything's working.
Yes.
Mike's advice to the kids, and as I say this, I have to reread it to make sure that I'm saying this right because it doesn't seem like a guy who's been successful would say this to a group of graduates about to embark on life.
Or a guy who wants to be invited back next
year. Right. Good point. Mike Rowe's advice to the grads is this. Do not follow your passion. Is that good?
I don't know.
I don't think that's good.
That doesn't sound like what you tell kids who are in their cap and gown. And
can I tell you what I would do? I would almost go the opposite. I would be the anti-Mike Rowe. And like Mike Rowe, I am also wearing a baseball cap. So I would go next to Mike Rowe. When he said, kids, do not follow your passion, I'd go, excuse me, Mike Rowe, Bill Leff, also wearing a cap. Kids, follow your passion. It's better to follow your passion. Didn't you? You followed your passion.
Absolutely.
You wanted
you
to
did.
Be. We did. You and I did.
Sure.
You and me, we did.
Sure.
So why would Mike Rowe tell them this? I'll explain in a little bit, but first a little side story. I went to Columbia College. I went all 4 years of school down the street at Columbia College. Mm-hmm. And we had quite often our teachers, the people who instructed us, did whatever they taught. They didn't just teach. But if I was taking a film class, it was from a guy that wrote or produced films. If I was taking an advertising class, it was from a guy who worked at an ad agency. And I thought that was great. I thought, who better to know this stuff than the people who are in the business? This is going to be beneficial to me. But that said, every once in a while, they'd bring in guest speakers. And many times, not all the time, but many times, their advice is, I know you what you think you want to go into graphic design. I know you think you want to be a voiceover artist. I know you think you want to blank, blank, blank. Don't do it. It's a hard job. It's not for everybody. I do it, but I don't want you to do it. And I'd always leave there going, oh, that's so sad. That guy does it for a living, and he's telling me not to do it. And then I realized, in a lot of cases, the reason they would do that would be to dissuade you, because then they don't have any competition. It's pretty smart.
Makes sense. Makes sense.
Very smart.
Well, you know, you hear people say, what do you tell kids who want to get into radio?
Mm-hmm.
To stay the heck out, right? But it's more, tell them it's too hard. Yeah, there are no jobs, this and that. But I think now I've changed. I mean, I always tell kids, they come in and meet with me. I always say, look, you can do it. It's going to be hard. You're going to have to work hard.
Yeah.
Get some breaks along the way.
Right.
But there are jobs in this business, and we're going to be around. And the business is going to be around.
Oh, absolutely.
And if that's your passion, you should go after it.
Because if you don't, at some point, don't you have friends who wanted to do something, and now at this age in their 40s and their 50s, they're regretting it, going, boy, I did well doing this, but I always wanted to do that, and I never did.
Bill, I got an email probably a week and a half ago from somebody who wanted to be a sportscaster.
Yeah.
He had been out in the business world for a long time. He wasn't enjoying what he was doing. He didn't have the money to go back and look at taking some vocational courses in radio, but he wanted to know, how would you do it? But there are, I think, a lot of people who, and I'm using radio as an example, got into something, really wanted to be doing something else.
Yeah.
They come to a point where they say, hey, can I make a right turn here and go back to doing what I originally wanted to do? But sometimes it's too late.
Right.
Often
that's sad. Isn't it sad?
It is very sad.
Then there's going to be some regret. At one of the stations I worked at years ago when I was at The Loop, there was a sports component, of course, to The Loop. And there was an intern that used to come in, and he was 60 years old. And everybody used to make fun of him, going, you know, most of the interns here are 20 years old, but you're 60. And I talked to him once, and he said, this is something my whole life. I wanted to be in sports TV or sports radio. And I always had a regular job and couldn't ever do it. And now this is my time, he said. And I'm having more fun now being a sports intern at the age of 60 than I did in my whole career.
Good for him. We had an intern here many years ago who was a pilot for one of the major airlines.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I don't think he came in his uniform, but he wanted to get into radio.
Yeah. And don't you love seeing that? I love seeing that.
Well, I would think if you're a pilot, you did pursue your passion.
Yeah. Ashley, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Ashley, I'm great. What do you think of Mike Rowe's advice? He's talking to all these college graduates, and he says, kids, do not follow your passion. Do you agree with that or disagree with that?
I hate to say it, but I agree with it, and it's unfortunate, but it comes down to money. And you had mentioned people wanting to be graphic design or going to graphic design or being a voiceover, and I actually have tried both of those. And here's what's wrong. As soon as apps for your phone started coming out where it made it so easy to alter images, and instantly you press a button and you have a filter that makes your image look so much better.
Yeah.
You don't need to pay somebody, you don't need to pay a graphic designer to do it for you anymore. It's so easy to do it yourself. So it's kind of like a dying art, which is really unfortunate because, you know, I think it's amazing.
It is amazing.
But that's just like the reality.
But don't you think if you don't, there will be some regrets at some point in almost every job, not every job, Ashley, but certainly the majority of jobs, you're up against technology and you're up against the hands of time and your business is going to change. So it's good to follow your passion, have a plan B. But if you don't follow your passion, at some point it's going to bite you.
I do agree. You know, I had an uncle tell me, you know what, you want to be in graphic design, don't do it. Literally the same exact advice that my girl is giving out.
Wow.
Do something that's going to make you money. And I hate that that's what it's come to.
Sure.
But, I mean, everyone says, you know, maybe try your graphic design as a side job. You know, take your plan B and make that number one.
Right.
You know, switch them. But,
tough.
You know, I don't. I hate to say it. It's just unfortunate.
I hate to hear it. Well, Ashley, thank you. Have a great weekend. Thanks for the call. All right. We've got a bunch of calls and a bunch of texts. Really quickly, once again, Mike Rowe of the TV show Dirty Jobs was speaking to some graduates, and his advice to them was this: do not follow your passion. I'll explain why, but we'd love to hear from you at 312-981-7200. It's Bill Leff and Dave Ennett sitting in for Wendy Snyder on WGN. It's me, Bill Leff, and it's Dave Ennett sitting right over there, and we're telling you the story of Mike Rowe, a good guy, decent man. He's on Dirty Jobs. He's one of those guys that just has this ability to just fix things. He just shows up and looks at it, and it's fixed. Well, he just told a whole bunch of graduates, and I quote here, do not follow your passion. I don't know if that's the best advice in the world. What are your thoughts? Give us a call at 312-981-7200. Let's talk to Ellie. Ellie, how are you?
Hi.
Is this good or bad advice?
I think it's kind of bad. My son, who is, I think he's 52 or 53, I don't know. Anyway, he was a lead guitarist. He was very good in a bunch of bands in high school.
Yeah.
And I paid for my kids' colleges. So he wanted to major in music. I said, no, maybe make it a minor.
Yeah.
I wouldn't let him major in music. He went into engineering, and he makes a really good living now, and he's always thanked me because he had friends who went on to music who didn't make it and don't have good jobs. So either have a backup or something.
That's the key to it, isn't it, Ellie?
Yes, have to have a good backup.
I agree with you. I do.
And he's paid me back for college in many ways.
Oh, that's nice to hear.
Well, I know.
Ellie, thank you. Have a great weekend.
Welcome. You too.
Isn't that nice to hear?
It is. Very nice.
It's so hard, though, when you have a passion that is one of those million-to-one shots like music or being an athlete where you just go, the odds are so far against me. But again, if you don't try it.
But, you know, I know a lot of people who work in the golf industry.
Yeah.
Their passion is golf. They want to work in something related to golf.
Oh, yeah.
Whether it's managing courses or whatever. I mean, there are ways you can do it and stay connected to whatever your passion
no
is.
No doubt about that. Dave, hi. You're on with me, Bill, and him, Dave. What's up? What are your thoughts on this?
Hello to all you guys and gals, et cetera.
What do you think?
What I'm hearing is just burning me up like everybody's not where I think they should be. It doesn't matter what age you are when you desire something to do. Just do it.
Yep.
What you need to do is if you've got a passion, follow your passion, but always be open, as the last caller said, to other opportunities that may come up that may satisfy you in many ways. I am an example of that. I got into the film business at the age of about 37. For the last 30-plus years, I have spent a wonderful time with people doing great fun and great jobs,
mm-hmm.
whether it was feature films, commercials, documentaries, docudramas, musicals, music shows, whatever the case may be. I've had a wonderful time. And at the same time, I still have a passion for doing voiceovers, which I'm still pursuing, whether
Good.
I want to bed a documentary or commercials. That's what my idea and that's what my passion is. And at the same time, I write short stories for kids. I do poetry, putting a book together. I don't care. I'm having a ball, and I'm enjoying it, and I may not be the richest guy in the world, but I've made some great friends. I've got some great acquaintances. I've got great kids who are also involved in the business, and I'm a happy camper.
What more could you ask for?
And you've got the pipes to do the voiceovers, too. Did you have to start at the bottom when you got into the film business?
Well, I went to a anniversary of a theater arts camp at their 25th anniversary, a lot of people that were at the camp were people who had gotten into the business. I came back to Chicago and said, this is what I'm going to do. The first film that I worked on was The Hunter with Steve McQueen. I followed up with that working in Blues Brothers, Risky Business, On the Right Track with Gary Coleman, Dollmaker with Jane Fonda, and eventually worked my way around to supplying on-camera vehicles in film. Worked with Arthur Penn in a film called Four Friends.
You've done all right. You have done all right. Yeah. Well, but Dave, that's solid advice. It really is, and I'm glad it's worked out for you. Have a good weekend. Thanks, Dave.
You guys do the same.
Thanks. Okay, take care. Here's a text from 708. I told my daughters to do what makes them happy. As far as the money goes, you'll find a way. If you enjoy your job, then it really isn't work. And that's true. It's sad that money has to play a factor in it. It's sad, but I know it does. But I would never, ever, ever tell a room full of kids graduating, no. Do not follow. As realistic as it is, I wouldn't tell them that.
It's the one time in your life to be idealistic and full of hope,
yep.
Knowing you can do it.
Yep.
Right?
Now, wait a minute. You think that and I think that, but Joey does not think that. Joey, you think this was a good thing to tell these kids, huh?
In a sense, yes, it was a good thing. I'm a college student. I currently go to Loyola University. I'm going to be entering my senior year. Mm-hmm. And one of my passions that I really love is video games. Now, if I wanted to play video games for... Sorry about that.
That's all right.
If I wanted
Here's
to
a Kleenex, Joey. Hold on. I'm giving you a Kleenex through the radio. You get it?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Oh, yeah, I got it. It came out through the microphone. That's weird. Okay. So, I love to play video games. And if I decided to play video games for the rest of my life, I would be broke probably within the first week.
Sure.
So... that being said, like, not following that passion is probably a good thing. That being said, I also love doing math and physics, and I'm a math and physics major at Loyola. So, I mean, some passions, like a lot of the, like, newer passions, like video games and stuff, like, that those kinds of things that today's generation likes are not necessarily as good of passions. Like, you really love video games and you love... stuff, maybe you can go into video game design, but that's like a hard area to get
into. I'll tell you, Joey, I know this is an ugly thing to hear, but it's true. A friend of a friend, there's a very close friend of mine who has a friend, and I've met him on several occasions. He's a video game tester, and you think to yourself, so he just plays video games all day? Yes, and he makes really good money doing it. So there are ways to do it.
Yes, but now also there are video games companies that are actually releasing their games early to the public, of course, and you paid for them. They're called Early Access Games,
mm-hmm.
And they actually allow people the general public, to play their game, and then the companies, instead of going through that route, like having these people play the games, they have everybody play the game, and they make changes due to their... observations there.
Joey, we have to run. We're short on time, but I appreciate the call. All right. Thanks very much. Dave, what were you going to say? I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say that I know somebody who works in video game design out in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, they do all right for themselves. Well. Yeah,
I guess those jobs are hard to get, but if you can get one, so are jobs in this business.
In almost every business.
Yeah, most jobs are hard to get.
Yeah.
If it's something you're passionate about, go for it.
I just wonder if when Mike Rowe was young, and it says in the story, and I didn't know this about Mike Rowe, he wanted to be an opera singer. I had no idea that was his.
I didn't know that.
That's what he wanted. But I think if somebody had said to Mike Rowe when he was that age, when he was graduating from school, whatever your passion is, Mike, don't follow it, that's a hard pill to swallow. That's really hard. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll find out what Steve has on the Wintrust Business Lunch. That's just a minute or so away. It's Bill Leff and Dave Annett sitting in for Wendy on WGN. Tim, thanks very much. Hi, everybody. It's Bill Leff. Part two of our show. Now, in part one, Dave Ennett sat in for Wendy Snyder, who's on vacation. She'll be back on Tuesday. Part two, the very shy, the very reserved Jim Toronto sitting in the second chair.
Hello,
how
William.
How are you? How nice to see
Hello,
you.
Hello, William. Any chance I have to use my Dr. Smith?
You got to. If there's a Lost in Space opening, you got to dive through.
I mean, I assume your name is William?
It is.
Hello. Is it Will? Hello, young Will.
It's usually Bill, but it says William on the gift on the gift certificate, the birth certificate. We got a gift certificate instead of a birth certificate Very when nice. I was born.
Well, your parents did.
Right, they worked for the McDade Corporation, so
for
we were
Myron
given,
and Phil's.
Yes, yes. How are you? Is everything good?
Very good. I'm vexed. I shouldn't say that. It's way too hot, and I know it's air conditioned in here.
Is this too
Is
hot
it on
for
at
you?
Your house?
No, of course not at my
of
house.
Course
you see,
not.
You should see my cat, my poor cat, poor yeah. Grimsby. She's sitting there with her tongue off to the side.
Oh, no, it's that hot?
Well, it is warm in there.
Kim, I said to Jim, Kevin and I were going across the street. There's a food court in the Nordstrom's building, and we, of course, invited Jim to come with us.
Right.
And he said no because it's a half a block away, and he said, I'll be all sweated up.
You might have a little schwitz on
yeah.
the way there.
Yeah, I'm already schwitzing. In fact, I before I came downtown to come here, I had to do a couple of errands, so I wore my usual. See, I get a lot of flack for, I always wear black. I like black, okay? But
yeah.
in this weather, it doesn't look, why are you wearing black? Blah, 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 blah. Okay, so fine. So, but I even knew I wanted to, I'm going to wear some summer wear. So I've got gray on today.
Oh,
I lightened up.
Very daring, John.
Well, I'm impressed you don't have your beanie on, because normally you have like on a winter
Yeah, my
cap.
Little hat. Well, I had to dye my hair back to
It's
my,
looking good,
the
I
dark
noticed.
Color.
Yeah.
No, well, see, once again, you know, we can get into this because nobody. I dyed my hair 2 years ago, blonde.
A much lighter shade, I remember.
Yeah,
it was kind of like highlights, right?
Well, it was blonde. It was blonde, blonde.
You looked blonde. And I don't say this negatively, but you looked like the Heat Miser from the Christmas. Yeah, when you had like orangish yellow hair, you looked a little like the Heat Miser.
Well, see, the problem was that I didn't want to be orange. I wanted to be blonde, but apparently my hair would not pick up the blonde.
Oh.
So it got, and as we all know, if you've listened to the show at any way, I am a member of the hair club.
And, yeah.
And so my system, it is not a toupee, it is not a hairpiece, it is a system.
Yeah.
So the system is one, to do this, this took a day and a half. Because don't forget, you're not just dyeing one head of hair.
Right.
You're dyeing two.
Right.
So they ordered the color that I wanted.
Yeah.
But now the goal is to match my hair.
Yeah.
With the ordered hair.
Oh, okay. All right.
Okay, so I saw this.
You can't just go to Earl Scheib and go,
no.
Let's do a number seven.
No, I went to Sherwin-Williams. I took one of those things. I said, this is the color I want.
The paint chips?
Yeah, the paint chips.
You're more complicated than a woman.
Oh, believe me. Oh, I was there for
I'm telling you.
I had to go back the next day because I went through every shade. I went from Andy Warhol to Billy Idol,
yeah.
to Bozo,
yeah.
then back to brown. And they were trying, when it was brown again, they yeah. were trying to convince me, well, this is close. I said, close?
You want exact.
I want blonde.
Right.
I said, give me my old one. Look at it, matches. What are you talking about? So then yeah. I was there for 5 hours. And they finally said, we can't do your hair anymore. It's going to start falling out. As if it that's why, but who cares?
You started with them originally for that.
So
reason.
I had to go back the yeah. next day, and I had to wear a cap. I was afraid the cap was going to blow off. And my wife hasn't even seen me, you know, because I got the system before I ever went bald. I
oh,
was
you did.
Thinning.
Okay.
So I didn't want to come in one day. And
preemptive
say,
measure.
Yeah, I did. I preempted by probably 10 years.
Oh, wow.
Just right. so there would be a continuity.
So you beat Brian Urlacher in this whole thing.
Oh, by far.
Oh.
By
years. You're so far
yeah.
ahead of the
oh,
trend,
yeah.
Jim.
Oh, yep. Well, that's my curse.
That's yep. you.
Yeah, but so... My wife, I mean, I don't even know what my hair looks like, my
oh.
real hair. I have hair.
Yeah.
I'm not complete. I'm not like, you know, Joe Garagiola. Google that.
The late great.
But, yeah. But so anyway, this was a major thing. And so it got lighter. It got, but I didn't like the orange part. But anyway, I'm doing a play. And so here's the best part. So I go for this audition, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I sent my headshot. My headshot I had with the dark hair.
Yeah.
Because I didn't get one done with the blonde.
Uh-huh.
So I walk in, and I guess the director saw me with dark hair.
Mm-hmm.
I walk up on the stage. Before I open my mouth to say hello,
yeah.
she says, would you dye your hair?
For the play.
For the play?
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, yeah, but I mean, do you just not like my hair? Or do you think the character needs dark
yeah.
hair? Or you just think I look horrible?
Yeah.
Because the funny thing is, and Kim just was interesting. She said, oh, I like it. I dyed my hair, and I was still here at WGN when that happened,
mm-hmm.
and nobody liked it. No, and I.
How do you know that?
Well, a few
There's
people
no way
said.
To know that.
Well, there they, is one way.
They point blank said to you, "I do not like
a
your hair."
A few people said, "I don't like it."
Wow.
And then the other people, I think that many times, if you do something new,
yeah,
if people don't comment,
what does that mean?
They're holding back their criticism.
I would be one if I loved it or if I
you
hated it, I wouldn't say anything because I think it's up to you.
Oh, okay. Well, then maybe.
Does that make sense?
But all I know is, so I went back to this. This has only been a week. I'm still getting used to seeing myself like this again.
Yeah.
And, but I've noticed a lot of people, oh, you dyed your hair back.
Oh.
It looks good. And I'm like, well, this is interesting because I'm getting all this, you know, oh, your hair looks good. And yet for 2 years, I never got that.
Nothing from them.
But,
yeah.
You know, to your point,
yeah,
I didn't care.
Yeah.
I really. Mm-hmm. I liked it. It was a change. I mean, I wasn't going to keep it forever. But now I'm even wondering, now, am I going to keep this?
Jim, the question on America's mind right now is this.
What?
Do blondes truly have more fun? You've had the dark hair. You've
yes.
had the blonde hair. And you're saying that as a blonde, you had more fun.
I did have some fun.
Yeah.
With myself.
Oh.
Because I'm the only one who liked it, apparently.
That's a bad sign. That's not a good sign.
Yeah.
But getting back to our original storyline.
What was that?
If you were to have walked across the street with Kevin and myself to get lunch, would you have honestly have come back all drenched? Is that possible?
My point was, when I went to run errands, I put on a different shirt
because
I knew within the 15 minutes I went to get gas and went to get some cat food, I would be drenched in that shirt. So I'd have to come home and I'd have to run and throw this shirt on quick and then jump in the car and put the air conditioning on. So from the house to the car.
It's that bad.
It is bad. I've always been that way. I mean, it's different. It's difficult to be virile.
Right. Yes.
And to have so much testosterone coursing
right,
through your
veins
when
yeah.
you're this macho, there's a downside.
You know what amazes me? I play tennis a lot. And when I play, now walking down a street, I could walk for miles and miles and you couldn't tell. I'd be fine. I wouldn't be
really?
Sweating or anything like that. But when I'm playing tennis or basketball or any
right.
sport, I do perspire quite a bit, but then I'll watch a tournament on TV. I'll watch the pros play,
right.
and those guys will be on the court for 2.5 hours, and it looks like they didn't even do anything.
Isn't that amazing?
I can't figure it out. What's in their genetic encoding where they just play all out tennis or basketball or whatever, and they don't sweat a bit?
Maybe that's why they're good.
That could be something.
Because
there could be something to that.
They have the stamina.
Yeah.
Because when I was a little kid, and into high school too, I played baseball, and of course I was a catcher.
Yeah.
And so I had all the equipment on. And you know, we'd play in the summer. And
right.
It was 90 degrees.
Right.
I would sweat through the chest protector.
Didn't you have a chest protector melt on you at one point? It just melted away.
Well, it's actually on me now.
It's still, you're still
you
wearing it?
You think I have abs.
It melted into your chest.
Yeah, you think I've got abs? This is just the old chest protectors from 1975. That's why it's ripped.
Here's a question from the world of upholstery, I believe. Do the curtains match the drapes? So they want to know, I'm guessing
they
do from
now.
An upholstery standpoint, if that's true.
Well, I'd have to go gray, I guess.
I guess you would. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll reevaluate, and then we'll come back. It's me, Bill Leff. Wendy's off for a few days. Jim Toronto sitting in. If you want to jump in, 312-981-7200. This is WGN. Jim Toronto is sitting in for Wendy, who's on vacation for a couple of days. The last time I saw you, Jim, a very short time ago at the WGN Radio Walk of Fame.
And I was sweating then.
You were sweating a little bit then.
Remember that day? It was very humid.
Yep. You were a little sweaty on that day.
I was wearing black because, see, that's the other side too. To camouflage, I wear black. So if I'm pitting out,
it's harder to notice.
It's harder to notice.
That makes perfect sense.
See, there's a method to the madness.
Oh, there is. Of course there is.
It's going to be changed the way I look at you now.
No, it can't get any worse, Steve Marino.
Now, do you know who was at the ceremony? And I saw you first, so I didn't get to tell you who was there. Yeah. But there was a notable from TV history, from Chicago TV history, that was at the ceremony. I see a guy. I'm walking around the crowd. Because everybody was focused up front, so I'm thinking, what better time to go through people's purses and pockets?
Exactly.
This will be very simple for me.
Every criminal is an optimist.
Every criminal is an optimist. So true. So there's a guy in the crowd who's got a pennant from Bozo Circus that looks to be sometime from the mid-1960s.
Wow.
You can tell it's a vintage Bozo Circus pennant.
A pennant.
Not a remake, but an original, and it's in perfect condition.
Yeah.
So I say to him, I just walk up and I go, hey, I don't know you. My name is Bill. I collect weird stuff. I said, I can't tell you how badly I covet that pennant. It's beautiful. And he said, I got that at work. I used to work on the show. Then I feel bad because I'm thinking I should recognize him.
Right.
I don't. Who could it possibly be?
Uh-oh.
And sadly, most of the regulars from the vintage Bozo Circus are no longer with us. We still have a couple, but most of them are gone.
Yeah.
So in my head, quickly, I'm going through the lineup going, it's not him, it's not her, it's not him, it's not him. And then I go, I hate to ask, but who were you on Bozo Circus? Were you on camera behind? He goes, oh, no, I was on camera. And I'm like, oh, the pressure's on. Who could it have been? It was the guy who was Golly the Gorilla on Bozo Circus. Like anytime they'd do a fair and square contest, it would be
Golly. Golly was always in a gorilla outfit.
Right, right.
And it was the same gorilla outfit that he used on the Lucy show. Because for some reason, in the middle of a Lucy show, when Ethel and Lucy were doing something, a gorilla would always show up. Yeah, it was that same one. So he was Golly.
Milton Berle had a gorilla. All the shows of that era, and the gorilla acting was always the same. You would always put your hands and fists and jump up and down in the air like you've seen gorillas.
And hit your chest.
Hit your chest. Gorillas do that. So he and I had a talk about what those days were like. And I tried to convince him, and I started out kidding, but then by the end of this conversation, I go, you got to write a book. You know, and he's like, you know, I should write a book.
Yeah.
Went, that would be an interesting
Tales
book.
Of Golly.
Right.
So did you see if you could buy the
No.
You didn't offer?
No, because
surprised.
It meant a lot to him. And then I'm thinking, I don't know what, I know in my head what it would have been worth to me, but I didn't want to take this is part of the guy's history. I didn't want to take that
away
from
him. But what color was it?
It was white, very, very American, red, white, and blue. You know, Bozo's, the costume we all know Bozo is kind of a royal blue.
Right.
But for a while, it was more of a reddish.
He was red.
Yeah.
Yeah, because in fact, I was just going to tell you, I've got a postcard, because I did go when I was a little kid.
Yeah.
And I've got a postcard of Bozo that they gave out, apparently, when you went to the show.
They would give out a set of them. You would get one of all the major players.
Yeah, and Bozo has the red suit, and then it's got Oliver O'Oliver and Sandy and Mr. Bob Trendler and Ringmaster Ned. And it's all crumbled now, because when you're a little kid, I mean, you don't think this is going to be.
Right.
But so, and I also have one of the Bozo, when you went later, they gave you a Bozo button.
Oh, really?
And I have...
With the whole cast on it?
No, just individual people.
Oh, they did.
And I've got a Bozo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you have the same thing when you first went in there, and it's the studios over on Bradley Place where WGN still is, when you would first walk in there, you were amazed at how small it was. Because on TV, you know, they'd say,
a cast
of thousands. You go, well, they're not going to say that. Ringmaster Ned wouldn't make that up. There must be thousands of people.
You big fraud, you.
I know. The other thing that jarred me, and we got to go to two tapings, including one when I had 103 fever.
Nice, twice.
Yeah, we went twice. One of the times my mom called
the
doctor.
Did you get it on StubHub or what? What did you get?
No, StubHub was Eric Soderholm's ticket agency gave it to us. My mom called the doctor. Wow. I had 103 fever, and she goes, I don't know what to do. We've got Bozo tickets. Oh. And the doctor goes, well, that'll take 7 years. You got to go.
Fever versus Bozo
doesn't
in the
matter.
1970s?
I know. You got to go. Go to Bozo.
Give the kid a cold pack, and let's go.
He'll live.
Yeah.
This is a once-in-a-lifetime thing. So we went there, and this I never thought about this watching Bozo on television for all those years until I was sitting there. The cast of Bozo, do the whole show with their backs toward you.
Exactly.
Because you're in the background.
Exactly.
Because we're all sitting there, and
that's
keep in mind
point.
I have 103 fever, so I thought it was Franklin Roosevelt's house. I didn't know where I was. So I kept saying, are they going to turn around like they do on TV?
Yeah.
No, they don't.
Although Bozo did have a nice butt.
Yeah.
So it wasn't
I got to admit.
Mr. Ned, not so much, but he did have the coverage with the long coat.
Right. Well camouflaged.
Yeah, exactly.
Well camouflaged.
Yeah. Oh, that's an interesting observation that everybody. Well, that's. Think about that. I mean, that is a completely different world of being in there. You're seeing the cameras.
Yes.
And then you're even, if you remember, you know, when they cut for a commercial.
Yeah.
Then they're just kind of, you know, moving off to the side. And,
right. They
and
don't continue the show.
Yeah, like, you're just thinking.
As a kid, you thought, well, the show continues when I can't see it,
I mean,
doesn't
Cookie
it?
Should be there making the French toast.
Right.
It shouldn't just come out. He's got to make it, right? And then he brings it out.
You know, the other thing that would happen, I don't know about you guys, but if anyone in our school was going to Bozo Circus, we, the kids in our school at St. Damon School, we'd watch it on TV.
Yes.
Because if we saw that kid on TV, that kid was then famous for the rest of their scholastic career.
Well, especially, I mean, I never, did you ever know anyone that got picked for the grand prize?
Yeah, two kids.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I never knew anybody. And then even that, you know, once again, when you're at home, and they just used to spin the camera
right
and stop it.
Yeah.
And you know, the high-tech WGN.
Ooh, it landed on a mom.
Yeah, and the WGN magic arrows. That was high-tech right. for 1970.
Right.
These blinking arrows.
Right.
They used the same thing at Cub Games. It's just like, go hit that thing that we used for the Cub Games.
Right. And, right, it was. It was the exact same thing. It was the same effect, yeah.
And like you said, oh, it's on a dad. Oh, well, and then sometimes it'd be like, there was like this big huddle, like in the baseball game now when they have the instant replay.
Yeah.
Well, is that on a mom?
Right.
Or is that on a boy?
Right.
You know, a bozo. You know, it's like, right. Okay, guys, it's just a little game. Let's get moving here. You know. But, I mean, all those tricks, you realized it was almost like a loss of innocence.
Oh, yeah.
Because when you saw it on TV.
It's magic.
It was magic. And when you got in there, you're like, you know, bozo's eating crackers.
Right.
He's smoking. Or right. he's sitting there with his legs crossed. You know,
is that like, what Bozo does?
It's like my dad, you know. And so you do lose a lot of that, you know, that magic, an innocence of it because, hey, they're putting on a TV show.
I know.
And even when you do the Grand March,
yeah.
Remember you did the Grand March?
Sure, at the end.
And, you know, everybody walked and then, you know, at home, when the people, if you remember, with people, the Grand March, they would have a camera right there,
mm-hmm.
and people would stick their face in
mm-hmm.
and wave. Well, at home, it looks like you're looking at me.
Right, of course.
But then you're there, and there's this, especially back then, there are these giant cameras that you know, look like you know the space shuttle,
mm-hmm.
and you're seeing people looking into them, and it's like,
that's not how it is.
What is that? Yeah, I almost didn't like going.
Yeah, it broke the illusion.
It really did.
It did. It said it, but true. All right, we need to take a quick break. Steve has the news coming up in a little bit, and then a lot more, including Ryan Burrow, who is on the scene at Muhammad Ali's funeral service. We'll talk to him later on as well. It's Bill and Jim Toronto sitting in for Wendy on WGN. All right, a lot of text coming in. Jim and I were just reminiscing about the magic of Bozo Circus. Here's a quick text, and we have a couple of calls. Text from 815. My brother got picked once for the grand prize game and missed the first bucket. Now, sometimes I remember seeing that. You would see a kid that was so excited. He's given the ping pong ball, and for some reason, even though it's just a half an inch away, they would miss it.
He couldn't go back to school.
No, you're done.
And this is even before bullying was anything.
Steve Bartman used to call that kid and make fun of him. That's how bad it got. Wow.
Well, there was a fireman who first dropped the ball, and then it hit Steve.
Right.
It
hit crazy.
Yeah.
It was crazy. Now, this is, you will recognize the name of this texter.
Who's that?
Joe Cornejo. Who worked
Cubs.
On Cubs broadcasts and
Joe
also
Cornejo.
WGN?
Yeah.
Golly the Gorilla was a man, Rich Louisa. That's the man I met outside, who was my first boss in the arts and faculty department. I ended up being the floor director for the Live at Noon Bozo Circus. That's I recognize his name from there and from Cub broadcasts.
Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who knew that Golly had such a deep history?
Oh, please, please. Let's take this call. This is interesting. Debbie, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
You had a little, I'm great. You had a little history with Bozo Circus, didn't you?
I did. I do listening to you, reminiscing about how small the stage is and you got the back of a, but I was in the center ring about five times. I did like this contortion act.
What was your name? Debbie, Jim just had a very fond memory. Debbie, what was your name when you did this? Was it Debbie in your own name or did you change your name for this?
I had these two stools, and it said Miss Deborah on each.
Oh,
what year was that?
So I'm like in my 50s now. I was about 12 years old, and then up. I did it for like five different times.
Yeah. And was it a pleasant experience? Would you say, Debbie?
I remember you.
I loved it. Oh. I loved it. Now that you talk about how small it is. The studio.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it back then, but it was. But it was fun. Cookie was the greatest. I loved Cookie.
Roy Brown.
Now, did you, by any chance, you did contortion things, you said?
Yeah. My biggest trick was I'd stand on these two stools, blindfold my eyes, and bend backwards and pick up a cup on the ground.
Geez, why isn't that show popular anymore?
That should
anymore?
Still be on.
Yeah, I mean, that's entertainment.
I love stuff like that.
You didn't ever do the, because I used to love the women that used to swing from their hair from the rafters.
Oh, yeah.
Remember
that? Yeah.
What was that?
I wasn't a swinger. No, I wasn't a swinger. Nope. Sorry.
So what did you, did you contort your body in all different kinds of?
I'm very flexible. You know, I can bend back and do a back bend and touch my head.
Still now?
She was very popular at prom.
I'm
I just did do a few things like the splits and
Oh, nice.
Wow, good for you.
Very nice. Yeah. Well, Debbie, thanks for calling in. We appreciate it. Have a great weekend.
You're welcome. It was good hearing about it.
Thank you so much.
She probably had one of those little spangled outfits.
Oh, of course.
The sequins.
That came with the kit if you were going to be a contortionist. I remember they would have circus acts from time to time, but again, because the studio was so low, even though it was called a high wire act.
It wasn't high.
It wasn't that high.
And there was no wire. And it was so weird because, like you were saying, they would have these people, and you would see the upper rafters of the studio.
Yeah.
It looked really low rent.
And always the same song for the guy spinning.
Well, I mean, let's face it. Mr. Bob, his orchestra had like three songs.
The Bob Trailer Orchestra?
Although, you know, that was a pretty big
band. I had all his album.
I think at one time, I'm almost positive, it was a 9-piece orchestra. And then it got smaller later on. They just had one guy. Professor Andy, right.
He just had a keyboard.
Just that was it. That was the budget cut, sadly.
17 people out of work.
But I know. It's too bad because they sounded really good. There was a lot of plate spinning. Like a lot of the acts that came on had a thing where there were plates on big sticks and they'd spin them.
The plate spinners. You had the dogs that were on two legs and would spin on a ball or something. Mm-hmm. The smoking chimpanzees.
Smoking chimps, right.
That was always fun.
We didn't know then, of course, that it was dangerous for chimps to smoke.
No.
Years later, we found out that chimp smoking is bad. But back then,
there were warnings on the side of their bananas.
Right. The Surgeon General made sure of that.
Yeah. You know, and then you had your jugglers, your magicians.
Yep.
You know, your stock and trade.
But the magician stopped when Wizzo became part of the regular crew.
Sure.
You didn't want to have a competing magician on.
Duty. The stone
of Zanzibar. My little sister, this is a text from 708. My little sister was chosen.
Oh, nice.
And she started crying and then wouldn't play the game because she was afraid of Bozo.
Well, a lot of kids are afraid of clowns.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I wonder if she won the big Tootsie Roll. Remember the giant Tootsie Roll?
It was a big Tootsie Roll, but didn't this have little Tootsie Rolls inside of it?
Yeah, and I think it was a bank, too.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it had a little slit for the bank.
And for people who don't know, it's true, Krusty the Clown on The Simpsons is patterned after Bozo.
At least somewhat his voice.
Dan Castellaneta, who does the voice, said he got that from years and years and years of living here in Chicago and watching Bozo Circus. So when you see, that's it. When you see Krusty and you think, that's sort of familiar, I don't know why. It's because the background is
Bozo. I always kid Dean Richards about his annual special.
Oh, the special's
which is
great.
Like at least 10 or...
Bozo, Gar, and Ray.
And Laverne and Shirley. And Fonzie and Potsy.
They're all in there.
Yeah, J.J. Walker.
It's great. I love that special. I watch it every year.
I make fun of him because I said, hey, can't you... You know, aren't there any DVD extras? Some deleted scenes? I keep seeing the same thing, but I'll tell you. And he goes, yeah, but you watch it every year. And I do.
You have to.
And when I think back at his special, because he's been able to find some nice clips, there's one clip where they are doing a skit, and it's toward the end of the run of the show with Bob Bell and Cookie and Wizzo, and they're doing a skit, and they are just going off the script.
I know.
And they are there's double entendres going left and right.
Yeah.
And it is the fun. And you could just see that these guys, they were getting to a point where they really didn't care anymore. Because they knew the kids weren't going to get these jokes anyway. And they were just having a ball.
Yep.
And it's
fun to watch that.
Yeah,
isn't
it is great.
Dave Player wants to jump in on this. Our friend Dave Player. Hi, Dave. What's up?
Hey, guys. What's up?
Hey.
You know, I got to tell you, the circus tent that you were talking about, like you would go up and you would see the rafters still in the studio. There is a canvas illustration of the top of a circus tent that's got to be 50 years old at this point that is still sitting in that room.
Isn't that cool that they kept it there?
Yeah.
That's real cool.
We were rummaging back there, you know, just for the Broadcast Museum, looking at some stuff. We actually found some panels for Mass for Shut-Ins behind there as well.
Oh, they did.
Mass for Shut-Ins.
We were talking about that on the show just yesterday, or Wednesday, actually, Steve, right?
My mom would never say, I would say, but Mom, I just want, that doesn't count. You got to go.
Yeah. You got to go to the real
I just watched Mass for Shut-Ins.
Not the same.
You're seven. You're not a shut-in.
I was an altar boy on Mass for Shut-Ins, and I remember standing there, and what I'd be facing is three pews and the News 9 desk.
Well, you were an altar boy in the Mass for Shut-Ins?
Yes, I was.
Wow, so you're one of my first TV heroes.
You and Spinner and Paddlefoot,
right,
Dave.
Yeah.
How about that?
Yeah.
Wow.
And Dave, the whole...
How do you get that gig?
It's not easy.
into the, it for you.
The whole set of Bozo Circus is at the Broadcast Museum, right?
Yeah, you know, there's some parts that are left. Like, we bought the organ from the Big Top Band a few years ago, so that's there. And then the original six buckets, even in the bucket. And people, go ahead, I'm sorry.
And the costumes as well, Bozos and Cookies and Mr. Ned, they're all, the costumes are there,
very,
too.
And the Grant, and the big, what's the tumbler?
The big drum with all the
mail. Yeah, the Bozo drum.
Big top drum.
Bozo drum still has the letters in it from the last round of kids that submitted their
Half of those are all those people are dead now.
Isn't that sad?
Think about that.
That's so sad.
Those letters, every one of those people are probably.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That's a cheery thought on a sunny Friday.
Yeah. It's really sad.
Dave, thank you for calling in. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, guys. All right. Have a great Friday.
That's Dave Plyer. Let's take a quick break. More on this and many other things to come. It's Bill F. and Jim Toronto sitting in for Wendy on WGN. All right. We're finishing up our discussion. Our roundtable discussion on the Great Bozo Circus. Here's a text. Jim, maybe you'll remember this better than myself.
I don't know. You're pretty good.
Jim, well, thank you, as are you. Jim Toronto sitting in for Wendy today. 708 asks this question about Bozo Circus.
Thanks, 708.
Wasn't there a segment where Bozo was hammered and he destroyed his set on television?
Well, I'll tell you, if you remember this thing I'm explained about just before the break.
Yeah. Where they all seemed like they had a champagne or two.
And for no reason.
Yeah.
Because they're basically playing the Three Bears.
Right.
And you know, they come in and who's, you know, and then of course Golly the Ape is in one of the beds.
Right. I remember this.
So they come in. There's no semblance of any kind of storyline here.
Right.
They're just riffing.
Right.
And even Cookie plays the mother and he goes, or Wizzo plays the mother and he goes, someone's been sleeping in my bed, and Bozo goes, well, don't look at me.
I know. It's everywhere.
And at the end, for no reason, they start destroying.
They do, don't they,
the
at the
set.
End of that?
They completely break the beds. They tear the walls down. So maybe this is the one that she's referring to.
It could be. Let's take Donna. Hey, Donna, it's WGN. It's me, Bill, and him, Jim. What's up?
Hi. Even before my kids were born, they said, request for tickets. They're free.
Wait, before they were born, your kids said that?
A lot of people would do this. Donna, right, back me up. You'd find out you were having a baby, so you would go and apply for tickets.
No, I wasn't even pregnant yet.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I had a little sister. She was 16 years younger than I was, so she was maybe 8 years old. And I figured, well, you know, she can go too, you know.
Yeah.
But I knew there was a late, and they were free tickets, so I got this postcard. It was, I didn't know how many requests, how many were allowed. So I asked for 8 tickets. I waited 8 years.
8 years.
I put this postcard in a safe. Heaven forbid. And my sister said, I don't care how old I'm going, I'm still going, right? So I put it in a safe. The 8 years passed by. We went to Bozo Circus, had a ball.
Sure.
My kids went through with Girl Scouts.
Donna, people are moaning about Hamilton tickets. You waited 8 years for Bozo tickets.
8 years for Bozo tickets, and then a month later, my kids went for a second time with Girl Scouts.
That's beautiful. That's great.
But I was not going to lose this postcard for anything.
I don't blame you.
Well, you know, the thing is,
Donna, thank you.
What people, younger people today, you can't, you know, we talk about these and we're reminiscing about them and we're explaining it, and it sounds like this happened 500 years ago.
Right.
But you really, you know, there was such, the world was so much smaller.
Right.
40 years ago.
We weren't as sophisticated.
And
we weren't as sophisticated,
and that show, there were only 5 channels.
Yeah, right.
You know, there was.
And 2 of them were fuzzy.
Yeah,
2 of them came in fuzzy.
Yeah, bad UHF.
Yeah.
And so that Bozo show, like you said, that the kid who got to go from your school the next day, he was a celebrity, you watched it in school. This was at that time, the second largest city in the country.
Right.
That show was so huge and so central to everyday life that there's nothing really that compares to it. And we were talking about this off the air. There was some rumors that, well, now that WGN isn't affiliated with the CW network, that they're more independent, they'll have some more programming time to use, and there was somebody who was floating the idea of bringing back Bozo. As much as from a nostalgia standpoint, it would be cool for about 5 minutes.
It wouldn't play as well.
I don't think it would play. I don't think today's, you're fighting two things. Today's kids, I don't think would have any connection to it initially coming to it. And then what's on the screen, they're taking that for face value. And what are you going to do with Bozo? Are they going to be entertained by plate spinners?
Right.
We in our 50s or 40s will watch it for the nostalgia thing. If they try to then gear it to the young audience, we'll say, well, this stinks.
Right.
It's not like Bozo was.
I know.
How do you win?
It's hard to sell that. It really is.
It's a moment in time. Let it sit.
Here's a question. We just had the texter asking if there was an episode where Bozo got drunk and destroyed the set. There were always rumors there was an episode that during the grand prize game, some kid said cram it clowny, and the response was that's a Bozo no-no, and they took the kid off to be tasered. Did any of that really happen?
I've heard, I think I've even asked Dean that, and I don't think they've ever found...
The footage of this?
The footage of that. Almost like, remember the famous story about Zsa Zsa Gabor and Johnny Carson with the cat?
I want to pet your cat.
Yeah. I don't know if that ever happened.
There was
on screen,
right? Something might have happened behind the scenes. We don't know. I remember as a kid thinking that I saw there was a clown on Bozo Circus, Sandy.
Right,
right.
Never talked.
He never talked. Now there was an episode where Sandy. Now in my head, I thought I saw this, where Sandy decided to go and play the grand prize game on his own. And he got the ball in the first bucket, then the second bucket, and then Sandy's body would tip to the third bucket, to the fourth bucket, and it was effortless. It was like his body contorted so that he could. And for years, I'm like, well, they couldn't have done that. There's no guy in the world that could bend his body to do that. Then when I got to college, I'm talking to friends about Bozo Circus, and one of the guys goes, I swear, there was one day I was homesick from school, and I thought I saw Sandy the Clown's body go completely to the sixth bucket, and he just put the bucket in. And then I have seen that footage. Somebody had it on YouTube or on a Chicago Memories website.
Right.
So it did really happen, and as a kid, you're not thinking about it, but he was suspended by wires, you know, over his arms. That's what made him be able
more
to do that.
More of the magic dispelled.
I should have said spoiler alert. I apologize for that. I apologize. 773 says Sandy was Ray Rayner. Not correct.
No, that was
Oliver O'Oliver.
Yeah, Sandy was, I think his name was Sandy.
Was it Don something? I think his name was Don something was the guy who played
Sanders.
Sandy.
I know there was a Sandy.
Yeah, maybe Don Sanderson or something like that.
I think there was some
like
connection
that.
To Sandy. Yeah. But no, that was Oliver Wilde.
And wasn't there a clown for a while named Clarence something that was like a Southern hick clown? Didn't they have a guy like that for a little while?
And then later they had about two or three clowns.
Adrian Zemed.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding.
I know.
From Primetime TV, Adrian Zemed for
you. Yeah, he was on T.J. Hooker.
Right.
And I saw him about 2 years ago on a cruise ship.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, that was pretty sad.
Oh.
Lane Techrad.
Yeah.
That's all he would totally talk about that.
Oh, really?
I'm from Lane Tech, right across the street.
He didn't bring up Bozo Circus.
No.
Just Lane Tech and TJ Hooker.
I don't think he did. No, because his cruise show was a trip down his career.
Oh, that's a good show.
So yeah. Oh yeah.
That's a great show.
So like it starts with the... You know, whatever you can get on a cruise ship, the skyline of Chicago, and then it goes to New York.
Oh, I like that.
And then it goes to L.A.
That's fun.
Yeah.
And was it his fans? I guess they call themselves as Medheads.
Smedheads.
Is that who comes out to see that?
I don't. I sat in the front. I didn't want to look behind me to see who was his Medhead.
So even though his show was about looking behind, you refused to.
I didn't.
Goes against the grain. Let's do this. We have to take a quick break. Steve has the news. Later on, Ryan Burrow is stationed at Muhammad Ali's funeral. We'll talk to Ryan and find out what's happening there. Stick around. Plenty of show ahead. It's Bill Leff and Jim Toronto sitting in for Wendy on WGN. Steve, thank you so much. It's Bill Leff in for myself, and then in for Wendy Snyder is Jim Toronto. Elton Jim, as he is known affectionately. Jim, I know how much you love music. I know how much music plays a very important role in your life.
My goodness.
Just remind people really quickly, because every time I hear the number, it knocks me down. You have seen Elton John in concert how many times?
164 and counting. I've already got my ticket for 165. I believe it's October 25th in Las Vegas.
That's fantastic.
How many Elton John concerts has Elton John seen?
I don't know if he's seen as many as you.
He's actually performed 4,000 concerts.
Has he really?
So look it. What 165?
Not even close.
It's even a blip.
Not even a blip.
I feel like I've underachieved.
well.
In many ways,
this
Steve.
This is where Steve and I would normally interrupt, but we're going to let you run with this.
No.
And how many different ways?
Yeah. Believe me. That's what my accountant says.
All right, listen to this and tell me if this makes sense. And I have not told you who the band is. You have not been prompted on this, but I'll tell you this.
I have not. Every band is in this story.
Every single band.
Every band.
There is a band from the 60s that was extremely popular for a good long length of time. And I'm not going to say totally went away, because they never totally went away. They always existed. But now all of a sudden,
the Beatles,
they're new. It's not the Beatles.
Okay.
All of a sudden, they've put out a new album and they're charting at number 14. It just came out on the Billboard 200 charts a week ago and debuted at number 14.
Are they ahead of Meghan Trainor?
They're not ahead of Meghan Trainor. That's a great question. Meghan Trainor's still ahead of this band.
It's the only person.
But for almost, from out of almost nowhere, this band, they did not have anything chart this high since 1968.
68.
And now all of a sudden, their new album, and I would tell you the name of it, but it doesn't matter. I will one after you guess, has debuted at number 14. Who do you think that band could be?
From the 60s.
From the 60s. Extremely popular in the
60s. Extremely popular.
Extremely popular.
Can't Kevin, you give me a hint?
Kevin, I know you have the music.
Wait, don't play the music.
Don't play it
know.
Yet, because then you'll get it
Can
immediately.
Can you just give me a... I mean, there's a lot of bands from the 60s.
When? Well, I'm going to give you a clue, but I don't know.
Are we talking about a rock band, pop band?
Somewhere in the middle. Oh. I would say more pop...
more definitive.
More pop than rock.
Oh, God.
More pop than rock. When they were at their peak, there were four members of the band. Sadly, that is not still the case, which I guess would be a clue that one of them is no longer with us. Right?
Oh, you know what? I'm going to
get it. You know who it is?
I think I'm going to get it.
Go ahead, take a shot.
The Monkees.
It is the Monkees.
Yes.
It is absolutely the Monkees.
Yes.
We got a bunch of people texting, all guessing the Monkees
yes.
as well. But it is, and that's because you got it because of what? Because you know one of the members?
No, because I just, I do keep up on my music. I get a British magazine called Uncut, as well as my Rolling Stone, and that album called
Isn't
Good
that
Time.
The Circumcision magazine that they put out in Brighton? I used to get that to the house, too. So
it's run by a bunch of moyles.
Yes, it is.
Since
1968, that was the last time they charted anywhere near this high.
It's called Good Time, isn't it?
Good Times. The new name of the new album. Okay. Now, did you know this about the Monkees? Because I knew this, and then in reading about them, I realized this. In 1967, the Monkees, which were patterned obviously after the Beatles, outsold the Beatles in 1967 and outsold the Rolling Stones. That's how popular the Monkees
for
were.
For a brief period, and I believe then Sgt. Pepper took them over.
Right.
But yeah, right. For a brief period, they did outsell the Beatles. And what's so funny is if you you look at some, there's some old pictures. Mickey Dolenz is hanging out with John Lennon.
Right.
It seems so wrong.
Right.
But they were a big, big deal. And there's always the story of how Jimi Hendrix opened up for them.
For the Monkees.
And Mickey Dolenz has said, I hired him. I wanted people to see this. And there's all these teeny boppers, you know, and he's starting he's leaning in front of his guitar, starting it on fire.
Right.
And they just want to hear Pleasant Valley Sunday.
I have to say, I mean, everybody musically has what they call guilty pleasures. There was a time where the Monkees were one of my guilty pleasures, and then I stopped feeling guilty about it.
No, there's no reason.
This is really good.
There's
music.
No reason to be guilty. That is great music. In fact, if you also, there's a great documentary called The Wrecking Crew. And what The Wrecking Crew was in California from the mid-60s through the mid-70s, 10 years. There were a group of studio musicians who played on almost every song. They played the drummers, the guitarists. They played the background for Captain and Tennille. They played for the Carpenters. They were on I think 150 number one songs.
Wow.
They were never credited because the record companies didn't want the people to know that the bands that they were selling
right
were not playing the Byrds, for example.
Yeah.
Were the Wrecking
Mostly
Crew.
Mostly the Wrecking Crew.
Leon Russell is one of the people that was in. Glenn Campbell was also.
Oh, yeah.
They went on to greater successes. And so the Wrecking Crew also played on the first Monkees. In fact, the whole story about this is that after they were being manufactured, then the music became so popular that they wanted them to tour.
Right.
Mickey Dolenz didn't know how to play the drums.
Right. They had to teach him I know.
How to play the drums.
He was an actor.
He was hired as an actor.
Yeah.
I mean, the show, it was supposed to be a TV show. And the music part was supposed to play a very, you know, just ancillary role. And then those songs became so big and the album sold so well that they had no choice. And you know, Mike Nesmith and Peter Tork were musicians.
Right.
Davy Jones was an actor, as well as Mickey Dolenz.
Yeah.
And they were never great musicians. But, you know, the funny thing about Mike Nesmith is he went on and is basically credited for
MTV.
Well, not even MTV, but actually starting the whole kind of country rock genre.
Yeah.
Because he had a band. And if you listen to some of the, like, listen to the band, there's a few, there's some country-ish songs that he sings lead on in the Monkees. And that sort of, along with Graham Parsons, sort of started that whole country rock where then the Eagles took that over.
Well,
and stuff
he put
like
out,
that.
There was a CD album and video called Elephant Parts.
Elephant
and
Parts,
I think it's
right.
the first the album where it was all, he did videos of all the songs.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that led to MTV.
And apparently what's interesting about this album too is not only I think are they've got a, they found an outtake of Davy Jones singing.
Mm-hmm.
So Davy is on this album.
He sings lead for one of the songs.
One of the songs. Yeah. It's called Love to Love.
Yeah.
And then there's also songs written by people for, like Rivers Cuomo from mm-hmm. From Weezer
mm-hmm.
and some other
one of the Gallagher brothers.
Yeah, and so they've got some originals as well as some of people that have been influenced by them. So yeah, I it's so funny because I was tempted to buy this album. I love the Monkees.
We'll play in a little bit. We'll come back from a break and play you a little bit of one of the new songs. They sound. I mean, I know they're a little bit more up in years right now,
certainly.
But they still sound good.
No, and my gosh, I mean, those shows are ridiculously goofy.
Yeah.
Once again, there's no point to them, but my goodness, if you have a greatest hits album of the Monkees,
yeah,
and I'll tell you, about 10 years ago, it was great when I was worked with Gary at another radio station. Davy Jones came in.
Yeah, he's a nice man, wasn't he?
Oh, he was a great guy, and we sang. In the studio with him, Daydream.
Oh, Believer. Nice. That's
and
fun.
My memory, I'm sitting next to Davy right. Jones singing Daydream Believer, and I'm sitting there going, I couldn't believe it.
I know, it's surreal.
You know? And he was the nicest guy. And I even had, you remember those cars from the 60s? They were like these they were like little toy cars.
Corgi made
Corgis.
Them. Yeah.
Well, I've got a Corgi.
Monkey Mobile,
and a Yellow Submarine, and as well as a Green Hornet and Batman, and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, which was very cool because the wings come out,
right?
But I had Davy sign the top of
that's excellent.
And he said, "Where did you? What is this?"
Yeah,
he had never seen.
He never saw it. Wow,
he never saw it.
That's crazy. When we come back, and I'll already ask you this question, but. The man who put the Monkees together is kind of something of a household name, but a lot of people are shocked at who it was who decided which four guys would be in the Monkees. So we'll talk about that. We'll play a little bit of one of the new Monkees songs. Like I said, charting at number 14 on the Billboard 200, kind of from out of nowhere because they didn't have that kind of success since 1968. So that makes it, that's huge.
Hey, hey.
We'll come back. If you want to jump in, you can at 312-981-7200. It's Bill F. along with Jim Toronto on WGN. If you're just joining us, it's not just me. It's Jim Toronto as well. Jim is sitting in for Wendy for the rest of the show. We were surprised. I was surprised. I think you were surprised as well to find out that the Monkees, who had not charted on the Billboard 200 since 1968, just debuted an album, Good Times, at number 14. Where do you think this came from? Why all of a sudden are they that popular?
Well, this
again?
Is their 50th anniversary.
Oh, I bet
so
that plays into
peg,
it.
So that's the peg, I think, where
maybe.
They decide to come together.
Yeah.
And there's one interesting thing, too. You know, Mike Nesmith has always been the reluctant Monkey.
Yeah.
He always, whenever they had, because they in the 80s, they got back together, MTV started to play the old shows, and they got another burst of popularity. They actually put out an album at that time, was kind of a greatest hits album with a few new songs called That Was Then, This Is Now.
Mm-hmm.
And Nesmith was not a part of that. There was just the three of them. What I found interesting, and I have nothing to to back this up except my own thing, is now Mike Nesmith is embracing the Monkees again. He's involved in this.
Mm-hmm.
He toured immediately. They did a tour last year.
He'll do if the tours are near his home. If they're in and around Los Angeles, he's in. But when they do a nationwide tour, it's Peter Tork and Mickey Dolenz.
Okay, because what I thought was interesting is that right after Davy Jones died, Mike got all excited.
Yeah, how about that?
And I said to myself, I wonder if there was some tension.
Oh, maybe.
With Davy Jones.
Yeah.
And now that Davy's gone, then all of a sudden now Mike. I have nothing to back that up except it seemed very strange. All of a sudden, after Davy Jones died, Mike Nesmith was back in the fold.
Yeah, how about
almost
that?
Almost immediately.
How about that? Well, people always said, and I know everyone on the planet already knows this trivia, but his mom, Mrs. Nesmith, invented correcto
basketball,
tape.
Right? Yeah, no, Dr. Nesmith.
That's Dr. Nesmith. That's totally different. Okay. That's totally different. His mom invented Naismith, the right, Dr. Naismith. His mom is the one who invented anytime you would have a typewriter.
Yeah, wait, hello.
Kids, Google that, kids. Yeah. A typewriter. She invented the process by which you could correct those mistakes. So I guess that family has lived very well off of that. So he didn't need the money.
Yeah, but his monkey stuff didn't hurt.
No. No.
Because he did have some writing credits, as we were talking before. The thing about the Monkees is not only did they have these session musicians that were playing all their instruments for them. So, I mean, these records sounded and were produced.
Yeah.
Great. But they also had some of the best songwriters
Easily.
Writing for them.
Boyce and Hart.
Yeah, Boyce and Hart wrote most of them. But you had Carole King and Jerry Goffin, who did Pleasant Valley Sunday. You had Neil Diamond doing I'm a Believer.
Right.
Some of the great Brill-building songwriters of the 60s, and Don Kirshner was the guy that was behind.
That was the trivia question.
Oh, is that the trivia question? Okay.
Who's the guy who decided who the four guys would be in the Monkees? And the answer to that is Don Kirshner, who later went on to host Don Kirshner's rock concert.
Hello, this is Don Kirshner.
A man with absolutely no camera presence whatsoever.
Well, the funny thing is, now here's the other side. Another interesting trivia question. Boy, I didn't know I knew this much about the Monkees. So they had a movie called Head,
yeah,
which came out in, I think, 68, yeah. 69. And their popularity was beginning to wane. And it was written by and directed by Jack Nicholson.
Yeah.
And he was friends with Bob Rafelson,
yeah,
who was one of the producers of the show.
Yeah.
And Kirshner actually got fired because, and here's another little tidbit, Don Kirshner was very big in Carole King's career. In fact, if you saw that musical Beautiful,
mm-hmm,
about Carole King's career, he plays a major role. And he was a big deal movie guy or a music guy. And when he was putting these together, you know, the band wanted to be on the records and they, mm-hmm, wanted to sing, they wanted to play. And he was like, hey, just don't worry, you just do your acting BS.
We'll take care of the musicians. Right.
So they hated Don Kirshner. Apparently, Davy Jones poured
a
bottle of Coke on him.
Yeah.
But the best part is, after dealing with the Monkees and having to go through that BS with them,
yeah,
he formed the Archies.
Oh, he did?
He was the producer of the Archies because he said, I don't have to deal with real people.
Right.
They're cartoons.
Right.
And so he created a cartoon band so he wouldn't have to deal with real people, and he had hit with Sugar Sugar.
How about that? It comes full circle. Let's get a call in or two. Mark's been on hold for a long time. Mark, we appreciate you holding on. We're talking about the newfound success of the Monkees once again. What do you know about this?
Well, I'm going to tell you, I tuned in a little bit late, and I heard you talking about the Monkees and the music and the TV show. And I loved all of it since I was a kid. And you know what? Even all of us kids, everybody admitted that they liked the show. It was fun to watch. I love that they have this new album out and that they're successful. There's one thing I heard that you were talking about the episodes and how they were kind of goofy.
Sure.
Pointless. But there's one thing that I read somewhere that I caught. If you watch that show, it came out when people were really afraid of youth culture,
mm-hmm,
with the long hair and the rock music and everything. That show, if you watch, it's a very basic good guys versus evil guys show where these four young guys are always helping people out of trouble.
Right.
And it's usually like a young, you know, the younger guy is helping out someone older. And I thought that was really cool. I never really thought about it, but if you watch every episode, they're basically bailing like the older people out of trouble.
Well, Mark, do you remember the episode? This is the one that sticks with me more than any other episode, where Peter sells his soul to the devil, yeah, to become successful.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing, yeah, that going, this is, wow, pretty deep for a kid's show.
Although I used to like the ones.
Pretty deep.
I used to like the ones when Davey and a girl had eye contact, and there'd be little stars in, right, Davey's eyes.
Right, that was great.
They would superimpose, right, stars in Davey's eyes.
So, Mark, you're right. It did have some merit. As goofy as it was, the show had some merit, right?
Right, and the one that sticks out the most is the one where Rosemary, I know she was on there twice, but
yeah,
there was one where she was a lonely older lady. She had moved. She was kind of displaced, and somehow she ended up in their house.
Mm-hmm.
And she tells her story, and basically it comes out she's just a very lonely woman. And they try to set her up, but it's very touching. You know, there's a scene where they're singing and performing a song for her, and she thinks back to her youth. And in the scenes, the flashbacks, she's dancing with each one of the monkeys. And I thought it was a really touching kind of a show. I thought, wow, that's actually touching.
It is.
For such a goofy sitcom.
And then they took the bed out into the street and crossed the street while someone was laying in the bed.
Right. They used to love to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Mark, you're right, though. Good points, all of them. Thank you so much. Have a good weekend.
Here's a good question for you, Bill.
Take care.
I don't know. I mean, you're hard to stump.
All right.
But I'm going to see if you can. You're probably going to know this. And we did not know we were talking about any of this. What was the name of the stuffed dummy?
Oh.
Remember that guy that used to sit there? Yeah. I can't remember it either.
I can't remember it.
I can't remember it either.
Right.
Maybe someone out there.
If somebody remembers, give us a call. I always thought one of the coolest things when I'd watch it was the fact that they would ride their motorcycle inside in their house. I'm like, well, that's, you know, your life is going well when you got a motorcycle inside, you ride it around.
You know what I loved, and I would love to do this. I can't do it at my house. I architecturally, I can't do it, but I loved the inner staircase.
Oh, yeah.
That right. round stair. I love that. I was like, God, would I love to have an inner staircase that's just round like that.
I know.
Oh, they had a very cool apartment.
We never got to play any of the music from the new. So do me a favor, Kevin. After the news, we'll bump. Oh, we can't because we're doing Muhammad Ali's funeral. That would be inappropriate.
Yeah, because the album is called Good Times.
Right. So that we can't do that. Everybody, come to my house after the show, and I'll play you one of the songs from the new Monkees album from Good Times.
Or just go on YouTube.
Oh, yeah, it's there, too. Good point. All right, a quick break. Steve with the news, and then more show. It's Bill Leff and Jim Toronto sitting in for Wendy on WGN.
Muhammad Ali floats like a butterfly and sings like a bee.
It's Bill Leff along with Jim Toronto. Jim is sitting in for Wendy for the rest of today's show. Wendy will be back on Tuesday. Ryan Burrow from the WGN newsroom is stationed in Louisville, Kentucky, where Muhammad Ali is being laid to rest today. Ryan, how are you? Everything good? Ryan? Hold on. We'll press a button or two. I'm sure everything is good. I'm answering for him.
Can you guys hear me?
There you are. Sorry about that, Ryan.
That other button.
Hey.
Ryan.
Oh,
go on.
Everything's great here. Yeah, the Muhammad Ali Memorial Service just got underway a couple minutes ago. We're expecting Bill Clinton to speak, Bryant Gumbel, the sportscaster, to speak, and who knows, we may even get some impressions from Billy Crystal. He's one of the people that's set to speak as well.
Why the delay, Ryan? They were supposed to start at noon, and then they postponed it a little bit. Is there any specific reason for that?
I think that the procession that came before this memorial just took a little bit longer than they expected. Initially, they said, they expected when they started winding through the streets of Louisville it to take anywhere between an hour and 15 minutes to an hour and 45, and that just wasn't feasible. Too many people out on the streets. I don't know if you saw any of the images, people throwing flowers on the hearse as it went by, people tapping, touching the glass, not out of disrespect, but out of respect for a guy who's done so much, not only for the nation, for the world, but especially here in Louisville. This was their chance to say farewell.
What about the mood? Anytime you're at a funeral, of course, it's going to be a somber mood, but his life was so filled with so many great moments. So how is that reflected in the mood of the people there, Ryan?
You know, this is a little different than Prince's funeral Prince's death, I should say. I think that was a little more unexpected. All indications are that this had been in the works. The plans for this, all of this stuff that we've seen in the last week, had been in the works for quite some time, years, maybe even decades. Muhammad Ali was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease back in the 1980s. So, I think his family understood his relevance, his point in this world, and wanted to do it the right way, to bring in the world, but also kind of put his hometown of Louisville on a pedestal. So, it's been a couple days here. We had the janazah, which was a Muslim prayer service yesterday. About 14,000 people attended that. The procession that went through the streets, which was public. And then this event that's going on right now in the KFC Yum Center, and that's the name of it. It's where the Louisville Cardinals play basketball. 15,500 tickets were snapped up in about an hour. So it's a packed house, and I got to tell you, there are people in suits, there are people in t-shirts, they're white, black, Asian, European. I mean, you name it, every religion, they're all in there. This is probably a rainbow of races and religions inside of this building, and that's exactly how Muhammad Ali wanted it. He wanted to bring everyone together.
Now, Ryan, I was wondering, you've been there for a couple of days, right? Have you been down
there
in Louisville? Now, it may be hard to tell, but so does it feel as if that this is an outpouring because in the town, suddenly they've been they're embracing the memory, or has there been, do you have any way of knowing, has there always been a very tight connection with Louisville to Ali through these years, or is it now just that he's passed away that it's his hometown and we're going to embrace him? Does it seem like there's a genuine thing, or is this kind of like a bandwagon effect? I'm just wondering how you can gauge that.
I do think it's genuine, and you find that by talking to the people who say, I grew up with Ali. I grew up in the neighborhood. I saw him. He came and spoke at my school. He, you know, signed an autograph for me. He was a Louisville guy. Granted, he lived in Michigan for some time. He lived in Chicago for some time. Obviously, he passed in Arizona, but he has his Muhammad Ali Center, a museum dedicated in his honor, not only for boxing, but also his humanitarian work and efforts. He has a street named after him. Muhammad Ali Boulevard runs right through the heart of downtown. And that these are all places that that were stops or at least slowdowns on his procession early today. No, these people here still feel that Muhammad Ali is their hometown boy. His nickname growing up was the Louisville Lip because they said he wouldn't shut up. He just kept talking and talking. You know, the irony is when the Parkinson set in, he wasn't talking much at the end of his career, but they said even his facial expressions and his emotions showed how much life he had in him. And, you know, they respect him not only for his athleticism. I think that we can all appreciate Michael Jordan's athleticism.
Sure.
In Chicago, but they said that you know, Muhammad Ali, it was the man behind it, the man who stood behind his convictions. He refused to go to Vietnam, although that was very unpopular. Got him booted from boxing for many years. You know, a lot of people didn't like that move. He converted from Christianity to Islam, which a lot of people didn't think was a very good move. So he stood by his convictions, and a lot of people respect that just as much as what he did inside the ring.
Kim Gordon in our newsroom grew up in Louisville, Kentucky. She knows a little something about this. What is the attitude toward Muhammad Ali there in town?
Oh, he's so revered. I mean, people love Muhammad Ali. Obviously, when he was growing up, it was a very, very hard time for African Americans in the city. You know, he's about the same age as my dad, and my dad would tell me stories about people, you know, black people couldn't eat at the same lunch counter. You couldn't use the same water fountain. But as time went on and things evolved and changed, he became very much revered in the city of Louisville, and he didn't forget his roots, and the city of Louisville didn't forget about him.
Well, you hear the story, and a lot of these stories I've been watching since he passed away. So he was 18 when he won the gold medal in the Olympics in 1960, and one of the reasons that he was so disillusioned was he had just won the gold medal representing the United States in the Olympics in Rome, and he came home, and just as Kim was saying, he came home and he couldn't eat at a certain restaurant or he couldn't drink from a certain water fountain. He's like, I just represented the United States of America, won you a gold medal, and then I come home and I can't act like everyone else.
It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense.
And it wasn't, the scary part is, it wasn't that long ago.
Right. No,
this
not
is not
at all.
Hundreds of years ago.
No, this is the 1960s.
Well, definitely. Very.
I was watching the, there's a thing with Bryan Cranston called All the Way. It was about LBJ.
Yeah.
And they're talking about the most of the movies about the civil rights. And they're basically saying it's been, in 1965, it's been 100 years since the end of the Civil War. We need to do something here, folks. It's been 100 years, and that's only 50 years ago.
Isn't that crazy? Isn't that something? So you mentioned, Ryan, a little while ago, you mentioned Billy Crystal. Billy Crystal speaks lovingly of Muhammad Ali and talks about how for their whole friendship, Muhammad Ali referred to him as his little brother. He called Billy Crystal's mom his mama all the time. They were so close in so many ways. We do expect to hear from him at some point today, right?
Yeah, he'll be delivering a speech just before former President Bill Clinton, kind of at the back end of this memorial service. And we're hoping we hear some of his impressions of the champ. They had a great relationship. You know, that whenever you hear about, like, media relationships between Muhammad Ali, one's Billy Crystal, the other being, of course, Howard Cosell.
Sure.
I've heard someone say that, you know, it's interesting because Cosell and Ali are probably sitting in the rafters right now inside of this arena making comments back and forth. Ali with his poems, Cosell with his play-by-play, just, you know, kind of getting their digs in while also respecting the moment.
Down goes Frazier! Down goes Frazier. Down goes Frazier.
Ryan, thank you. I know that there's a lot of mixed emotions there in Louisville, Kentucky today, but what a great man Muhammad Ali was, and he'll always be remembered.
I think you're right. I think a lot of people will be talking about him for the years to come.
Sure.
It's not just going to be a day. It's going to be a long time people are going to remember him. So thank you, guys. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Ryan, and thank you, Kim.
You know, Bill, and I was just going to say, too, if people are traveling through Louisville this summer, it definitely is worth the stop to go to the Muhammad Ali Center. It's a really cool museum, and there's a lot of really neat things to say, and it's right in the heart of Louisville. So you just go right into downtown Louisville, and it's right there.
I've never been there but heard such great
things
about it.
It's really, really a neat place to visit.
I got
to
go.
Now it'll be, you know, even more important.
I would think.
And Chicago has a piece of Muhammad Ali's history. He lived here
for several years. Yeah, for quite a while. Billy Crystal, I don't know if you're aware of this, Jim. Maybe you are. They did a one of those Friars roasts of Muhammad Ali. Oh, and like all the roasts, like the Dean Martin roast, it was a who's who of celebrities. Everybody famous except for one guy, Billy Crystal, who nobody had really heard of at the time. But they knew that he did an impression of Muhammad Ali and of Howard Cosell. So he went up there in a room filled with the top echelon of talent, and nobody knew who he was when he walked up on stage, and he absolutely destroyed the room, and then all of a sudden everyone knew who Billy Crystal was.
I was just going to, in fact, I can't believe you're going to say, because I was going to just say that.
Same story.
I mean, it was this guy, like, who the heck is he?
Right.
And he came up, and at that time, too, what's so great about some of impressions, it's when somebody not only nails somebody, but when they're the first ones to grab it. And at that point, as big as Ali was, as a star as he was, nobody did an impersonation of Muhammad Ali. And then the irony is that here's this short little Jewish guy. It's not some big black guy who's doing Muhammad Ali.
Right.
It's some short little Jewish guy. And he's doing, as you said, the back and forth. Hey, Howard. And it was perfect.
Yeah.
And I remember, and he even did the eyes, like the way Ali would bulge his eyes. And I remember watching, I saw that.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow.
Yep.
I was impressed. I was probably 10 or whatever I was. And I was like, whoa, that is unbelievable.
One of the best.
Yeah.
And
that probably was one of the things that helped, you know, elevate his career.
I remember them cutting to, when they would show this, they would cut to Muhammad Ali, who's sitting at the main table, and there were tears in his eyes from laughing.
Now, was
so
that
hard
on the Dean Martin roast?
The way I remember it is Dean Martin was there, but for some reason I remember
it was
this being a special entity.
Okay.
It was a roast of him. I could be remembering it wrong.
Because he was on the Dean Martin roast.
Right. Which, often.
Yeah. But I mean, they did actually, he was the roastee.
Yeah.
At one time,
right,
too.
But so
he
maybe
also
it was.
Yeah, I don't know. But
maybe
I just remember when Billy Crystal walked out, I mean, he nailed that voice.
Yeah.
And the whole repartee.
Yep.
Which, and we were talking about this before off the air, too. People don't even realize, especially, you know, once again, you see athletes now, they're doing commercials, they're doing movies, they're entities, they're brands, you know, LeBron and all this. Ali really started that.
No question.
There is no question that he elevated the role of the athlete, of not just being an athlete in a box,
right,
but a media star. He was on television. He had a cartoon. He had comic books, action figures. This guy was huge. And I heard a story that Bob Costas said last weekend, where he was in a plane with somebody, Ali, and he was flying over, and they were getting close to landing, and you could see the houses.
Yeah.
And Ali told whoever he was traveling with that he said, you know, right now, if we landed this plane right on that street, he said, I could walk and knock on any door.
Yeah.
And they would know who I am.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
And they would let me in.
How about that? Well,
he was that well known.
For a long time, he was the most recognizable person on the planet. Ahead of world leaders. I know this is sacrilegious to say, but in a lot of ways, ahead of the Pope.
Yes.
He'd be the guy that if around the globe you showed somebody a picture, they would more likely recognize him than
anybody
else. And
what was really interesting, because my dad was from the Depression era, and he grew up with Rocky Marciano.
Yeah.
And my dad, of course, was Italian, Toronto. Yeah. So Rocky Marciano was his guy.
Sure.
So when Ali came, and Rocky Marciano, and most of the boxers especially, and that's when boxing was really a major sport. It's a sport now, but you can't understand how big boxing was in the 40s and 50s, and even into the 70s.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Tyson brought it back. But so my dad, I remember, I mean, you know, Ali was an affront to him.
Yeah.
Because not only was he, you know, loud and boisterous and saying how he was the greatest.
Yeah.
You know, but my dad sitting there going, Rocky Marciano never lost a fight. you know, and he was, so this was kind of like a generation gap. Take the politics aside of the Vietnam and the Islam conversion. This was a, such a different breed of an athlete who actually stood up and said, I'm good.
Right. Athletes, not just good, I'm the greatest.
But athletes before Ali were very humble, very soft-spoken. You know, here's Joe DiMaggio, one of the greatest baseball players of all time. If it wasn't for him doing Mr. Coffee commercials in the 70s, he really wouldn't have been that well-known.
He would have faded away.
By another generation.
Yeah.
And so Ali really shaped and was controversial because of the fact that he shifted the game. Not only was he a different kind of boxer, he wasn't a slugger. He was fast and he moved, which was different than the big sluggers like a Rocky Marciano. But he also changed, and it was very difficult for a lot of people to accept that.
Yeah,
and then think about in the 60s, difficult not only to see this brash, pompous guy, but a brash, pompous black man saying that.
Yeah.
It was a challenge. It was a game changer.
Without a doubt. Our memories of Muhammad Ali, if you'd like to jump in, please do. I got a bunch of texts, 312-981-7200. We'll get to those in just a little bit. It's Bill Leff and Jim Toronto sitting in for Wendy Snyder on WGN. All right, we've got a ton of calls and a ton of texts, and we only have a couple minutes, so let me just quickly get to one or two of these. Jim, thank you so much for holding. You knew Muhammad Ali a little bit, huh?
Yes, we did. My wife, Esther, and I had an opportunity. We were invited out by Lonnie, his wife. On February 13th of 2014, we were out there visiting some friends in Paradise Valley, Arizona. Lonnie Ali has been a customer of ours since 08, buying clothing protectors from us for Muhammad. And so, you know, we always used to have him monogrammed with, of course, his catchphrases of float like a butterfly and thing like a bee. And then we had some monogrammed and embroidered where it said, let's knock out Parkinson's with boxing gloves hanging on there, and then a bumblebee with boxing gloves. But we had an opportunity to spend about 2.5 hours out there with Lonnie and Muhammad. And during the time he was there, he was already pretty quiet. You know, he would just look around, you know, and that was, you know, that's 2 years ago. So, and Lonnie's sister, Marilyn, who pretty much takes care of him when she's on the road doing her promotions for Parkinson's and things like that, was just a lovely lady. It was a lovely visit, and we chatted just like we would at any other kind of a family get together. And they were just so, so just outgoing for us. And when we met her at the door, Lonnie, she put her arms around us and hugged us and said, "Come on in."
Oh, that's
and
nice.
Muhammad was there.
That's so nice.
It was a great experience back then, you know. So
and even though you got to meet him in the later stages of his life, you still realize you're in the presence of greatness, right? There's still some aura about him that is just unmatchable.
Oh, yeah. You know, he just sat there and he allowed us to come up. We shook hands with him, you know, and then my wife got in front of him and he picks his arms up, wanted a hug from her, you know. I've got some great pictures of that. And he was actually smiling in them, you know. So
good.
Lonnie let us take some pictures of him and with us, you know, and we have them and we'll cherish them forever.
I can imagine.
It was just a great moment. Yeah.
Jim, thank you. Appreciate the call.
You're very welcome.
Have a great weekend. All right, we have to take a quick break. Rowan Ann will be in. I just quickly want to say to you, Jim, thank you for coming by. It's always a blast when you're here.
Oh, thank you. Anytime, William.
And you're filling in
for
Dean Richards.
I will be on this Sunday from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m.
Listen to Jim Toronto, as he said, filling in for Dean Richards this upcoming weekend. You'll have a great time. Back after this, Bill and Jim in for Wendy on WGN.